You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Silvio Carrillo. He is an Oakland-based freelance multimedia journalist, director of the website BertaCáceres.org, and nephew of Berta Cáceres, a Honduran activist who was assassinated there in March 2016 after being awarded the Goldman Prize for her environmental activism. Carrillo just wrote the New York Times op-ed, America's Blind Eye to Honduras's Tyrant, which I recommend reading. I don't usually recommend reading the New York Times. Silvio, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So you've written about the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez of Honduras, and the legitimacy of his election. What's the story there?
Well, it's a pretty complicated story, but to simplify, he illegally changed the constitution, or actually attempted to change the constitution, which that in itself is illegal, according to the Honduran constitution, got himself stuffed the Supreme Court with people that support him, and got himself back on the ballot, well, with U.S. approval. It was generally pretty basic, but it's taken a long time to be able to do this. Manuel Zelaya tried to do this in 2009, and that was the reason why there was a coup in 2009, and it was supported by the U.S. And now this government has managed to get themselves Juan Orlando has managed to get himself reelected with the support of the U.S. government, and it all has to do with access to for the U.S. to military bases, access to training military Honduran military, and which is a big business for the Defense Department, and the State Department is ignoring any kind of human rights violations, any kind of corruption. And they're just going along with their man, Juan Orlando.
So the U.S. position on the Constitution in Honduras is as inconsistent as its position on human rights and anything else. That is, Zelaya better not touch it, but Hernandez can go ahead.
That's right. It plays in their favor. There is an understanding between Juan Orlando and the U.S. Embassy there and the State Department. And it's a pretty happy relationship. He can pretty much get away with anything. Clearly, he's already killed. His forces have killed at least 30 people since the election.
And those forces include U.S. trained fighters. Is that correct?
Well, the deal is there's a little caveat there. There's a specific police force that Juan Orlando created. Now, that specific police force apparently was not trained. That doesn't mean that they are not supported by U.S.-trained groups. And also, it doesn't necessarily mean that people haven't been trained by the U.S. and moved into that force. So there is this military police force that is surrounded, basically, by U.S.-trained forces.
But the post-election violence, this election was back in November, I guess, was violence from the side of the government, of the president or the claimed president, or from protesters?
Well, it was the protesters who were protesting stolen election were out peacefully, attempting to have themselves heard.
Right.
And the Honduran government sent out these police, this repressive police military forces, to control and contain people who are rightfully protesting their right to a free and fair election. And yeah, they even stopped and took photos of IDs. They do this all over the country, but they did that to my cousin, who is now running the organization that my aunt, Berta, organized and ran. And they stopped and took photos of all of their IDs. All the people were members of COPIN, which is the name of the organization that my aunt created, and were taking photos of their IDs. This is an indirect threat to them, to their lives. It means that they have their photos and can at any point identify them and single them out, target them.
There's this public relations firm in Washington, D.C. called Keybridge Communications, which a lot of people who can afford to will pay $5,000 to get their op-ed into U.S. newspapers for them. You wrote that Juan Orlando Hernandez hired this Washington, D.C.-based PR firm to spin the story of this violence. And I haven't heard any sort of outrage whatsoever, much less on the level that we would hear if the Russian government had hired some Washington-based PR firm to spin something. This seems to be generally okay with the U.S.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no doubt that the Russians probably have, right, several firms, but this isn't the first or only one that the Hondurans have paid. In 2009, it was Lanny Davis, who was of the Clinton circle, and he even got a hearing in 2009, where he was able to justify the coup that had just occurred, and he was lying through his teeth about how you know this was justified. This whole coup in 2009 was justified, and so they're doing it again. They had a different PR firm back in the summer. They've recently hired this new one, Keybridge, and they did manage to get an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. The person is a very conservative writer who's written several op-eds against Venezuela and against other countries in the region, pushing extreme right-wing policies, and she's done it again for them earlier, I think late November, maybe early, I guess it was really early December, and got it put in the Wall Street Journal. And so these are the kinds of tactics. I mean, the Honduran government they're not amateurs at this, and they're probably getting some guidance from the U.S. State Department or from other organizations related to them.
We're speaking with Silvio Carrillo. See the website bertacarceres.org. Silvio, the U.S. State Department, you write, sort of reapproved a position that would give millions of dollars to the Honduran government, U.S. dollars to the Honduran government, just 2 days after this disputed election. Is that right?
That's correct. It's a certification they have to get every year for the State Department, for Congress to release money. And so what happens is that the State Department certifies that Honduras has completed all these levels of human rights abuses, and like they've got all these levels where they've got to reach, and the State Department is claiming that they've reached them. And it's hard to believe that they would say that they've reached these levels, because for the last 10 years it's been nothing but violence in Honduras, and perpetrated by the Honduran government. It's not exacerbated by the Honduran government, who's armed its police forces to the teeth. I mean, there's a reason why 120, almost 130 environmental activists, that's just environmental activists, have been killed since 2010. In journalists, the number of journalists that have been killed is surprisingly high as well. It's one of the most dangerous countries in the world for journalists, and there's not a war happening in Honduras. So
One of the most dangerous places in the world for anybody, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much anybody. And this is, you know, this it's a vicious cycle because this justifies Juan Orlando's claim that he needs help from the U.S. government to fight crime, drugs, or whatever. And then people are why would you stay in a country like that if you're, you know, if there's violence everywhere? Your heroes, you know, Berta Cáceres, my aunt, the few heroes that this country has, you know, you get assassinated. Like, why would you stay there? And of course, we're adding to this because then we train their police, we train their military, and we give them money. I mean, we gave them a share of $750 million, the Alliance for Prosperity program for the three countries, the Northern Triangle countries. And we continue to justify this because of the violence that allegedly is the crime rate. There's claiming that they're dropping. The Honduran government controls the crime rate. So there's no way of actually telling if the crime rate is actually going up or down because they control, the Honduran government itself controls the crime rate.
Yeah. Well, this is, you and I don't do these horrible things. This is the use of we to mean the U.S. military and the U.S. State Department.
Right.
But it seems that there are a few Congress members who have raised concerns. Have they done anything? And what could they be doing or should they be doing?
Well, what we should be doing is pressuring more congressmen to sign on to the Berta Cáceres Act, which is the H.R. 1299, which was introduced by Congressman Hank Johnson, in March of last year. Now, that bill so far has about less than 80 co-signers. And, you know, we're not delusional. We it's a Republican-controlled Congress, so we don't necessarily believe we're going to get to a vote on the House floor for it, but The more we get, the more co-signers we get, the better it is, because it shows that there is a movement, that there are people who are very concerned about this us funding, basically, violence in Honduras perpetrated by the government and corruption.
Is there a Senate bill, too?
No, not yet. There is talk of a Senate bill. And this event in late November, the election will probably, hopefully, we'll be able to help us introduce them.
Very good. We should work on that. I think a lot of people, of course, are not aware of what's just happened, but a lot of people remain unaware of what happened in 2009 and what role that played in creating the government and the society that now exists in Honduras, and the role of Hillary Clinton's State Department in facilitating that coup. Can you talk about what the evidence is of the U.S. Support for that coup 8 years ago?
Sure. What happened was, as soon as, well, I don't ever, I mean, it's pretty well known if you read reports from around that time that Zelaya wasn't really well-liked by the State Department. This was Manuel Zelaya, who was elected in 2006, democratically elected in 2006 in Honduras. And what he did was he did things like he raised the minimum wage for the second poorest country in Latin America. He did many things that empowered the indigenous people on the right. The right wing was upset by this. The business elite that controls the finances in Honduras, the 10 to 15 families that own everything in Honduras, literally everything. Now, Zelaya wasn't a saint, of course, by any means. But as Zelaya went along during his term, he began to have a closer relationship, it seemed, with Chavez, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, and the State Department did not appreciate that. And so when it came time for the coup in 2009, in June of 2009, the State Department kind of looked the other way, even as the U.S. ambassador in Honduras, Hugo Lloren, was sending cables back saying this is completely illegal. Not that there's a legal coup, but this is a made-up reason for this coup. And it has no legitimacy. And you can see it in his WikiLeaks cables back to the State Department. Yet Hillary Clinton came up with this plan to negotiate. Now, that's an important word. This negotiation means once you say that word, it means that it's over. The struggle is over. It means that the U.S. is going to impose itself. It means that they're going to control the outcome. The outcome has already been decided.
Because the question is whether the government is legitimate, and you're declaring that you will negotiate with it, so you're making it legitimate.
Right. Exactly.
The Silvio Carrillo, the role of the U.S. military, not just in the coup, but in U.S. thinking about Honduras, is something that you've brought up. What do the people of Honduras think of U.S. troops being based in their country, and how big a factor is that in all of these calculations?
The history of the U.S. in Honduras and Central America is pretty horrific. Whether it's establishing military bases or helping to organize coups, they've been heavily involved and intricately involved in ruling Central America. And it's not just about maintaining a sphere of influence. It's about protecting U.S. businesses. It's about protecting U.S. military and keeping an eye over Central and South America and drug interdiction as well. But, this began in the 40s, 30s with the Dulles brothers who imposed themselves in certain places, especially in Latin America. The role of the military, people, in general, you don't see them that often. I see them, though, every time I go to the airport in Tegucigalpa. I always see some kind of military member. But the Honduran people themselves, I think they would wish they would stop imposing on Honduran affairs. But I don't think they have a major issue with them being there. I think they could probably establish a really positive and good relationship if they were in line with what the Honduran people wanted, which is just to be a democratic country that doesn't have corruption, that can look towards its heroes and be like, oh, I want to be like this person because they're a person of dignity, and they are going to help me. I'm going to help them bring this country back to where it should be.
But how does a foreign military presence work with becoming a democracy? It seems in contradiction to the idea.
Yeah, I think for a place like Honduras, people probably won't agree with me when I say this, but I think it's sadly an accepted fact of life in Honduras. And they've come to terms with this because of so much intervention. Now, that should not be the case, but it is. And in Honduras, they can, I believe that they can survive with a U.S. military there. I think there's an understanding of why they should be there. I think there's also fear before these coups. I think to a certain extent, the U.S. military based presence offered some protection to the Honduran people from their own military force, sadly enough. It's really an incredibly complicated issue, and I don't like saying it, but, maybe having a military there is good for a reason, but it shouldn't be for this reason.
It's very interesting and surprising to me. You look to countries like Costa Rica that have decided more or less to get rid of the military and countries like Ecuador that have said, you know, we don't need the U.S. military in our country. And, you know, of course, you hear news from Korea and Japan and the Philippines and Italy and Germany, of, you know, all the people who so bitterly resent these U.S. military troops being in their country. And you say, I mean, if the people of the United States were to take hold of their government and say, you know, we don't actually need to have bases in, to have troops in 175 other countries, we'll bring them back to this country, would the people of Honduras actually protest and say, no, we want them here?
That's a good question. I couldn't tell you what the answer to that is. People like Mel Zelaya would say, of course not, right? But I think there's a certain amount of stability because of the history in Honduras that where they might want them there. There's also a certain amount of mistrust of their own police and military. There's a huge drug trafficking problem. They don't trust their elected leaders. And so I think there's a bit of a, maybe there's a bit of a balance that Hondurans might believe they can strike, but not, you know, not, this is just over the top and ridiculous what they're doing now.
Indeed. Speaking of which, the topic of your aunt's assassination, Berta Cáceres, the evidence apparently is quite clear, but no prosecution is forthcoming. Is that the current status?
That's correct. The evidence is clear. There was an independent international investigative team that a group of lawyers that looked at the evidence that was given to the prosecution by the government to prosecute these eight individuals who are alleged to have committed this crime, none of them being the mastermind. And so this tiny bit of information that was given by the Honduran authorities to the prosecution is what these lawyers looked at. And what they came up with was connection that went all across the government and state security forces. And nothing's been done about it. That information is just sitting there. And the Ministerio Público, which is the public ministry who does the investigation, is sitting on much more evidence that probably, who knows how high up that goes, but they're not doing anything with it, and they're not doing anything with it on purpose. They've been delaying the case for months, and the judge in this case has demanded that the government present more evidence, but they refuse to. They don't even show up. So the case is just stalled and not going anywhere.
And do you think that's because, in part, because of how high up it goes, and how high up do you think it goes?
Well, I absolutely think it goes up very high, if not to the top. It was clear she was, as I wrote, a thorn in the side of this government, and she was not going to go anywhere. She was not going to give up, no matter how much they threatened her or how much they attempted to throw her in jail. They even tried to plant a gun on her and claim it was hers, and the charges were thrown out. I mean, they tried everything, and they, you know, they had to resort to their way to deal with these things in Honduras, and that was to assassinate her. And this is, you know, I mean, it's scary to think if with this small amount of evidence that this group of lawyers looked at, what else is out there, the amount of evidence that they have.
I guess the other thing I want to ask you about as someone connected to Honduras but in the United States is U.S. immigration policy. I mean, here the U.S. is assisting in the destruction of a country, helping to make a country more violent and less of a desirable place to live, and yet further restricting admission of refugees and immigrants into the United States. Is there a real insult added to injury here?
You know, that's right. There is the U.S. is exacerbating this problem, and the current politics are are making things, if it's at all possible to make things worse, they are. There's no solution for these people who are trying to escape their country, which is wracked by violence and corruption. And it's shocking to think that this is, I don't even know the right word to use. We are not just fomenting this, but exacerbating it, and it's obvious what is happening, that we are making this problem for this country when we should be helping to create more heroes in Honduras, especially the people of color in Honduras and the women in Honduras. This is what we should be doing, is helping these kinds of people create a community instead of destroying it.
And are people in Honduras aware of the role of the U.S. State Department and the U.S. government in supporting coups and illegitimate elections?
Yeah. That's what this vote was about. They voted Juan Orlando and 80 years of U.S. policy out of office. That's what they just did. No one's talking about that, but that's what they've just done. He is so close to the U.S., to certain members of Congress, and to John Kelly, who's the Homeland Security, Director of Homeland Security. And this is where he gets his power from here in the U.S. This is where he gets his support. And that's why there's been unending support from the State Department.
And people know that, and they oppose it, and they're willing to go and vote and oppose it, and then to protest when their votes aren't counted, and yet they want U.S. soldiers in their country. I'm still struggling with that one.
Well, I wouldn't put it that simple. It's not that simplistic. My analysis and being a peer, I don't, born and raised in the U.S., of Honduran, family, Guatemalan family, but I think the Hondurans aren't, let's say, as reactionary as, let's call it Mel Zelaya. He's not, he would certainly not want U.S. military presence in Honduras. But I think there's a place somewhere in the middle if that presence was going to be doing some good in the country. And right now, they are certainly not.
I wish we could continue the discussion. I'm wondering when they did do some good. We may be able to have you back on,
but we're
quickly running out of time. We've been speaking with Silvio Carrillo. He is Oakland-based. He's a freelance multimedia journalist. Check out the website bertacaceres.org. Support the legislation that is written about there. The New York Times op-ed, America's Blind Eye to Honduras's Tyrant. We will have all these links up at talknationradio.org. Silvio Carrillo, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be on again. We can continue the discussion. Don't worry.
It sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, though it's largely slipped from the front page, more than a third of Puerto Rico remains without electricity. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to leave. Struggling schools and hospitals are still in the crosshairs of targeted austerity programs, and workers are facing cuts to their pensions and their jobs, even as they try to dig themselves out from under the effects of Hurricanes Irma and Maria. Meanwhile, the New York Times describes the banks and hedge funds that are preying on the situation, scooping up the homes of people unable to pay their mortgages, for example, as bargain hunters. Different people have very different visions of the way forward for Puerto Rico, depending, to put it simply, on whether you think servicing debt matters more than human beings. It is, as a report from the activist group Hedge Clippers describes it, a story of pain and profit, and an important cautionary tale with meaning far beyond the island. Julio Lopez Verona works with Hedge Clippers. He's also the founding organizer with Make the Road Connecticut. We'll talk with Julio Lopez Verona about those seeking profit in Puerto Rico's pain and how we can change that story. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. When Donald Trump took office, the country's elite media indicated they'd be keeping a watchful eye on the reality TV host's puffed-up rhetoric. Skip ahead a year, and you'll find the New York Times front-paging a story headed, "The Trump Effect: Business, Anticipating Less Regulation, Loosens Purse Strings." The piece, by Benjamin Applebaum and Jim Tankersley, claims that a wave of optimism has swept over American business leaders, inspired by the Trump administration's regulatory pullback. The story touts an increase in investment, noting that non-residential investment has risen at an annual rate of 6.2% in the first three quarters of 2017. For the missing skepticism, you'll need to look to progressive economist Dean Baker. He points out that, first of all, this is not an especially rapid rate of growth. Investment grew at an 11.4% annual rate from the first quarter of 2011 to the second quarter of 2012, for instance, and it averaged 8.9% annually over the 8 years of the Bill Clinton administration. But also, Baker notes, the growth of investment thus far during the Trump administration has been quite concentrated. The mining and oil sector accounted for 43.3% of the rise, meaning investment in the rest of the economy has been a very lackluster 3.3%, despite any optimism unleashed by eliminating life-protecting regulations. And this investment in the mining and oil sector is almost certainly far more attributable to the rise in world oil prices than anything Donald Trump has done in office. Oil prices had collapsed, falling from close to $100 a barrel in 2014 to a low of $32 a barrel last year. This slump led to a plunge in investment in oil and mining in 2016. This year, oil prices have begun to rise again, recently topping $60 a barrel, and investment in oil and mining in the U.S. rose along with world oil prices, although they're still below the Obama-era peak. So, if you believe Donald Trump controls the price of oil in a global market, you could credit him. Otherwise, it looks like corporate media buying and reselling just the sort of hype they claimed they'd be scrutinizing on the public's behalf. Indeed, U.S. outlets do little to puncture hot air claims from the White House when these align with their own long-held worldviews. For over a year, the corporate press have insisted that the tactic of deflecting criticism by pointing to others' flaws was the devious Soviet tool of whataboutism, and anyone using it was practicing one of Russia's favorite propaganda tactics. Well, if that's so, as FAIR analyst Adam Johnson recently noted, when it came time for CNN's Jake Tapper to spin for the Trump administration's deeply unpopular move of the U.S. Embassy in Israel, the most trusted name in news was Peak Pravda. Tapper's late December report, borrowed right from the Trump White House talking points on the UN vote, 128-9, against the U.S. moving its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, a gesture that would effectively solidify 50 years of illegal military occupation. Tapper's claim was that the UN was singling out Israel at the expense of bad countries. Among the 128 countries that voted to condemn the U.S. on this issue, Tapper charged, were some countries with some questionable records of their own. He then listed official bad guy countries, Venezuela and Syria, as well as Yemen, a bizarre choice since Yemen's UN votes are cast by a government in name only that's been displaced by a rebellion. And Tapper ended with vague innuendo suggesting that the only reason these countries would single out Israel was anti-Semitism. You have to ask, Tapper pontificated, is Israel truly deserving of 86% of the world's condemnation, or possibly is something else afoot at the United Nations? The average viewer at home might come away thinking 86% is a really high figure indeed. They surely wouldn't guess that countries like Syria, North Korea, and Iran are routinely discussed at the Security Council. In fact, before last year's rare abstention by the U.S. on a resolution about Israeli settlements, the last time the U.N. Security Council even mentioned Israel in a resolution that actually passed was a kind of wrist-slapping, condemn-both-sides statement over the occupation of Palestine in 2002. The UN hates Israel so much, in other words, that its most consequential legal body went over 14 years without passing any measure against it, despite the occupation being a clear-cut violation of international law. But why does Tapper arbitrarily list a few of the 164 countries that didn't support the U.S. rather than describe that group as a whole? Why not mention France, Britain, Germany, Sweden, etc.? You can guess that that might have complicated the implication that the U.S. is taken for granted as the world's moral arbiter, and the only cynical actors are those daring to question this moral status. Carrying Trump's water when it suits them, major U.S. media at the same time willfully interpret things in a different way when that suits them better. Whitewashing, obscuring, or even rewriting the broader U.S. record by presenting Trump as an aberration. That tactic was on display December 28th in a nominally straight news report from the New York Times' Mark Landler on how Trump has reshaped U.S. foreign policy. Adam Johnson shook out this gem of imperial agitprop amid an otherwise banal analysis. Quote, "Above all, Mr. Trump has transformed the world's view of the United States from a reliable anchor of the liberal, rules-based international order into something more inward-looking and unpredictable. That is a seminal change from the role the country has played for 70 years under presidents from both parties, and it has lasting implications for how other countries chart their futures." Close quote. That the world viewed the United States as a reliable anchor of the liberal, rules-based international order is just false, according to poll after poll after poll, showing that much of the world views the United States as a threat to peace, or even the single greatest threat. What evidence Landler has for the world viewing the U.S. as a sort of good-natured global babysitter is unclear. He cites nothing to support the claim, though it's key, because if Trump's cynical disregard for human rights is nothing new, then there's no real story here. Perhaps the assumption is that the Times readership is nationalistic or just amnesiac enough not to notice or to care. Such statements seem designed to flatter more than elucidate. but many, many Americans do know enough to side-eye the assertion that the United States is viewed as being, or by implication objectively is, concerned with liberal rules-based international order. Did Landler, Johnson wonders, miss the part where the U.S. runs offshore penal colonies for untried political prisoners, or the decade-long drones war that's killed thousands, both entirely outside the scope of international law? Or the bit where the U.S. refuses to sign liberal rules-based international order treaties, such as the International Criminal Court or the ban on bombs or a prohibition on nuclear weapons? Or how the U.S. not only doesn't recognize the International Criminal Court, but has a law on its books, dubbed the Hague Invasion Act, passed in 2002, that if an American is ever held by the ICC for committing war crimes, the U.S. is obligated to literally invade The Hague and free them. Landler seems to start the clock in 1947, which would include dozens of non-liberal, non-rules-based coups, invasions, bombing campaigns, assassinations, extrajudicial murders, and so forth. So what exactly is this liberal, rules-based order, and when did the world view the United States as its most reliable anchor? The Times doesn't even make a case. They just assert it so they can move on to pearl clutch about Donald Trump ruining the U.S.'s hard-won moral authority. If this is elite media challenging Trump, readers are not much better served than if they just ran the White House press releases. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Puerto Ricans who want to stay in their homes forced to flee because life and work are not tenable, while wealthy investors and hedge funds push for more cuts to the island's services to maximize their own profits. It's a distressing scenario, even more so when you realize the situation I'm describing predates Hurricanes Irma and Maria that so devastated Puerto Rico last year. Puerto Rico has slipped from the nightly news, but behind that shroud of relative inattention, things are happening that compound the impact of what might be called natural and unnatural disasters. What can be done? What would a humane way forward for Puerto Rico look like? Julio Lopez Varona is the founding organizer, now the outgoing director of Make the Road Connecticut, and an activist with the group Hedge Clippers. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Julio Lopez Varona.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start with the present. With many people forced to leave the island to make a living, and with economic incentives for investors to come in and buy stuff up, I have heard it said that we could be moving toward a Puerto Rico without Puerto Ricans. Can you walk through some of the factors that are in play and some of the concerns? What's going on?
Well, it's interesting because this had been like one of those things that was a conspiracy theory for a long time, but now we're seeing it actually happen. Over the last 10 years, as you mentioned, Puerto Rico has been in this great humanitarian crisis where the economy has plummeted after many, many years of changes in the tax code and colonialism and a long history of just neglect from the U.S. government. But within that, we've also had Puerto Rican governments that have decided that they want to incentivize the entrance of rich people to Puerto Rico through laws like Law 20 and 21 that actually made it almost a tax-free haven for people that invested more than $1 million. And while they did that, they actually raised taxes for working people in Puerto Rico. And this combined with, you know, extreme unemployment of 12%, which is the highest in the nation, with 45% or more people living on under the, you know, poverty lane, you get this great exodus of people that are just desperate looking for work that they can't find in Puerto Rico, while at the same time you get just a flock of rich people that are going in and buying cheap, trying to make this the island where it's better to be a tourist than actually be someone living on the island.
Well, in the wake of the hurricanes, we saw this two-person company with Trump connections, Whitefish Energy, get a no-bid contract to rebuild the power grid. You see that kind of deal and you can sort of smell it, you know, and that deal was in fact quashed. But a lot of the predation that's going on, it's not, strictly speaking, illegal. I wonder if you could kind of explain what these vulture funds are. How does that work?
I usually tell people it's very, very similar to what happened in Greece and Argentina. These were countries that were in great economic depression, and the governments, the same as the government of Puerto Rico, had no way of sustaining its debt, and it had been passing, you could say, the ball of debt from one government to the other until Puerto Rico was in a position where it had no credit. So vulture funds or hedge funds have, like they did in Argentina and Greece, came in, they offered money for Puerto Rico, knowing that Puerto Rico wasn't going to be able to pay back. And about 3 years ago, when the government of Puerto Rico said, we're not going to pay back, these bondholders decided to start pushing back. And they did that by pushing back through pushing us extreme austerity measures that have destroyed collective bargaining agreements in Puerto Rico. They have lowered employment when it comes to government employees, when it comes to any sort of protections for working people. Right now in Puerto Rico, we have less hospitals than ever, less schools than ever. We have privatization of public corporations as something that has been happening for the last 20 years. And with Maria, we see that it happens more and more. So it was very much conscious attack of very wealthy people that saw Puerto Rico in a position where it could be attacked. These hedge funds and corporations are moving forward a very neoliberal way of running the island. And they're doing so because Puerto Rico has no way of going into bankruptcy. Puerto Rico has no way of actually dealing with its debt. The solutions that the U.S. has put forward are board, which is called the Fiscal Control Board, that now control all the budgets in Puerto Rico. And ironically and sadly, the same people that are in the Fiscal Control Board, many of them are the same people that made this disaster happen. People connected to Santander, people connected to past governments. So in many ways, the remedy is worse than the cold for Puerto Rico. And with Maria, this has all been exacerbated. Failing infrastructure that is now completely destroyed. People that had no jobs that are just fleeing the island by drones. So the conditions were there for a disaster, and Maria just made it worse.
It's a very strange understanding for those of us who have just kind of a tangential understanding of how these things work, because we always hear that, well, investment involves some risk, you know, and now the island has been devastated. So how on earth would you expect 100% repayment?
That's the question. But for them, we feel like the answer has never been about repayment. The answer has always been about what they can do in the island and how they can hold the island hostage so they can put forward their policies they want to put forward. When we're talking about repayment, we're talking about people that bought debt for 30 cents on the dollar, meaning you give me 30 cents, I will give you a dollar. And it was clear that they were never going to get that repayment. When we looked at some of the findings around banks that did deals with Puerto Rico during that time, we saw interest rates that were high up to like 785%. And I don't know about you, but I've never heard about any sort of bank telling us to pay 785% interest rates to get a loan. And just to give you an example, that meant that at some point Puerto Rico got $3 billion and now has to pay $30 billion. So when you talk about the debt in Puerto Rico, people say it's $70 billion, but what we find is that Puerto Rico already paid its debt, and what it's now paying is actually interest rates imposed by these hedge funds and these banks.
There was a recent series by the magazine In These Times and the Centro de Periodismo Investigativo in Puerto Rico that showed just how secretive also this stuff is. You would think that it would be fairly straightforward to just find out who, in fact, owns Puerto Rico's debt. You know, who are they? I know that Hedge Clippers is very interested to name names, but it is not that easy always to dig this stuff out.
It is extremely difficult. We worked to find that this person called Klarman, who's head of the Baupost Group, is one of the biggest investors in Puerto Rico, and he has about $1 billion in debt that he owns, and this person had been hiding for 3 years. I think at the end of the day, this has to do with the fact that what's happening in Puerto Rico is immoral. And when you're telling people they should not eat so that a billionaire can have one more Ferrari or one more apartment in Manhattan, these people start to hide because no one, I don't think anybody in their right mind has the scruples to do this openly and expect groups like Hedge Clippers and Centro de Periodismo Investigativo not to push them, and for people on the ground not to be outraged and try to do something against them.
Well, then I read these stories from the New York Times from the fall, and they're describing what's going on, but they describe these banks that are coming in as bargain hunters.
I think one of the biggest issues that happens is that for many years, the blame has been put on the Puerto Rican government and the Puerto Rican people. And what we find is that the conditions that have put forward the situation in Puerto Rico are a combination of colonialism, a combination of a U.S. government that doesn't care about Puerto Rico, and the fact that many corporations are actually running our country. And those corporations have, in many ways, taken advantage of the situation that Puerto Rico has. And I think that the important part about this and the part that people should know about this, like Puerto Rico is maybe the biggest and the best example of what happens when capitalism has no restrictions and there's no way of controlling it, because this is happening in Puerto Rico as an island to 3.5 million people. But when you look at Detroit and Chicago and other places, this is happening in smaller scales. And this is not bargain hunting. This is actually predatory practices that are destroying communities so that people, very rich people, can become richer.
Now, I know that you worked with a coalition on a series of short films with Brave New Films, preying on Puerto Rico, forgotten citizens of Hedge Fund Island, is a kind of pushback media, you know, while we have corporate media kind of blanding things out, talking about bargain hunting. And that same piece indicated, you know, few people are going to shed tears if these, you know, billionaire hedge funds lose money, but their interests really are aligned with the interests of Puerto Rico itself. But there is media that is exposing these ties. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the pushback. There is work being done.
Well, I think for us, the work has been about how do we uncover these practices in a way that's understandable. As you said, it's difficult to understand. It is difficult to really navigate because it's so technical. But what we find is that there are clear villains in this story. And if we can draw a narrative that really talks about who are the bad people and what are they doing to common, like, normal people living here in Puerto Rico, and really connect those stories to, you know, create that contrast between the guy living in Manhattan and the person in Puerto Rico that doesn't have a roof, people start thinking about those contrasts. Because I feel like at the end of the day, people understand that nobody should live without a, you know, without a roof or have nothing to eat, while these big hedge funds and corporations are just, you know, thinking about how they buy an island. So I think our work has been about doing the research and doing good research, but doing good research that translates into popular education and that connects to Make the Road and other organizations that are doing the work. So part of that means like creating strong coalitions that can actually move that information to the ground. I think one of the exciting parts about what we've done in coalition with other groups is really change the narrative from this is about a bad government and bad Puerto Ricans to this is about hedge funds and vulture funds have actually unintentionally attacked our island. One thing we have found is that these people do have their public image and they do care about their public image. And working with pension funds and working on corporate accountability campaigns, we've been able to actually do some impact. And for example, in New York, we were able to divest $2.5 billion from a hedge fund that was hurting Puerto Rico. So there are ways to have an impact, and there are ways to create a narrative that people really resonate with.
Absolutely. Well, just as vultures have a vision for Puerto Rico, and I think for a lot of listeners, the the point of reference can be New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, where we know it was seen as kind of a, oh, now it's a clean slate. You know, now there is an opportunity to push for a lot of things that folks wanted to push for anyway, for privatization, for charter schools, for example, and the hurricane just kind of made that easier for them. You know, so we see that they have a vision. We've seen it play out in some other places, but other people have a different vision, you know, for Puerto Rico as in other places. And that has to do with real investment in infrastructure, real investment in schools and in medicine. There is a different vision on the ground in Puerto Rico, is there not?
Yeah, no, and I think the core of it is that it has to be led by Puerto Ricans. It has to be the voices of Puerto Ricans living in community, the ones that have stood up over the last 3 months and have created their own civic community organizations and decided that they were going to, you know, do what needed to be done. Those should be the voices that we're hearing. You know, we have a crumbling infrastructure, and that infrastructure, there is a way to reinvent our infrastructure. So it really like takes into account the environment and the fact that this island is sunny and warm, you know, all year, and we could use the power of the sun. I think there is a need for Congress to actually make a Marshall-type plan investment in Puerto Rico so those things happen. Puerto Rico should not be paying any of its debt. That debt was paid, and in many ways, the hurricane, as Trump said, wiped out the debt. And it's a moment where we don't need to be thinking about what are the debts we need to pay. We need to think about how do we invest in the communities that are doing the work. How do we change the way that Puerto Rico deals with agriculture and infrastructure and electricity, and actually making sure that the people living here have opportunities? So our hope is that a lot of people are thinking about a Puerto Rico for Puerto Ricans and not a Puerto Rico for rich hedge funds and vultures.
Do you have any final thoughts on what you'd like to see from journalists or what you would like to not see from journalists as we go forward?
I think my biggest thought is that Puerto Rico as a small island is a representation of what's happening in other places. So if you don't care because you don't care about Puerto Ricans, care because this is coming to your neighborhoods, this, you know, extreme austerity measure driven neoliberal model that cares more about people that are rich making money, is something that we see in Puerto Rico, but we also see everywhere. And I think people have to be ready to find who are the bad guys and start actually holding them accountable for the hurt they're doing in Puerto Rico and in their communities.
We've been speaking with Julio Lopez Varona. You can find Hedge Clippers online at hedgeclippers.org. Make the Road Connecticut is maketheroadct.org. Julio Lopez Varona, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Into a new year with a new climate. In this program, we will look back and forward with the remarkable Dr. Paul Salomon from Rainforest Trust. Content warning, a little optimism may creep in. Then one of the strangest outcomes on a warming planet, babies who experience even a short period of heat stress in the womb will, on average, have a lower income 30 years later. Think about what that means. As we explore new science led by Dr. Maya Rawson Slater from the Stanford School of Medicine. Earlier in December, Alaska and Yukon were hotter than parts of the lower 48 states and where I live. A friend returned from the far north, where they wondered if they would have a white Christmas at all, in the Yukon. California experienced its largest ever wildfire, not in the usual summer fire season, but in December. Now we have a cold Arctic blast over most of North America. Right on cue, President Trump makes his first presidential tweet on climate change, saying, quote, "We could use a little bit of that good old global warming." To celebrate the end of his first year, where he passed more legislation than any president in the history of the universe, Trump has removed the safeguards on fracking put into place by the Obama administration. Go ahead, pump toxic chemicals near the schoolyard and in national parks. We will never ask you what's in those fracking chemicals, because we can't. Meanwhile, the Philippines is trying to clean up after yet another deadly tropical typhoon, as the hits keep on coming. I'll cover all that, but we won't stop there. It was never my role to be a disaster reporter. Instead, this year, we will continue to dig into the causes and the processes behind the news. And I'll be looking for any source of real optimism and voices helping us cope with an unstable world. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. ...2017 was a dizzying mix of dangerous politics and environmental records, and not the records we want. What really happened? Is there anything each of us can do to help? We will find out. I know it's common to look back at a year, but it is uncommon to have the eyes of one of the world's leading conservationists. Paul Salomon was inspired as a child, and he managed a small nature reserve in London by the age of 14... His work in South America helped create new nature preserves in Colombia and other countries. Growing up as a birder in the UK, Paul helped found Fundación Pro Aves, the South American charity for protection of the birds. Four new bird species were brought to science by him, and after a distinguished career in science and conservation, Dr. Paul Salomon is now Chief Executive Officer for Rainforest Trust. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex.
I appreciate you helping us out. So before we get to some personal New Year's resolutions, let's work through the top five impact stories from your report. At number one, we have the retrenchment of a leading world economic and military power. Is the American withdrawal from the Paris Accord a blip or a blow to climate progress?
Well, I think it's somewhere probably in the middle, to be honest, Alex. I think the U.S. continues to be the leader in the environment and leads on innovation and technology that's going to help lead to the renewable energy solutions for the future. However, of course, it's disappointing that the federal government is no longer taking that leadership role. I mean, it's just, for the first ever agreement of any area to have all 194 countries sign up to it is remarkable. I mean, it's the first time in the history of mankind. And now, unfortunately, the U.S. has pulled out of it. It's just a really tragic, disappointing decision. But we do hope it will reverse in the future. And I know that, if anything, it's made efforts at the sort of state levels and city levels actually much more important. And I think on the ground, we're going to see more action happen. So actually, if anything, it may actually be a good thing in the future. But, of course, it's disappointing that the federal government's not leading on this.
Paul Salomon, please talk to us about the emergence of extreme weather events.
Yes. So, I mean, as we've known, we're preaching to the converted here listening to your radio station. We've all seen the statistics. There's no doubt what's going on. I think that we should highlight, looking back at 2017, the fact that 13 U.S. agencies came together to publish the Climate Science Special Report, together unanimously noting that impacts so far in the last century has been 1.8-degree increase, and the outlook is a further 2.5 degrees in the coming decades, and that is man-made. That's clear in the report. So this isn't in doubt. This isn't something that's we still need to look through the data further. I think the main thing is we've just had this terrible year of really severe environmental impacts from extreme weather. You know, in 2015 and 2016, we can say, okay, it was the El Nino phenomena. We can say that there was always going to be some variation and some extreme impacts. But this year, this 2017, was supposedly a normal year for weather in terms of there was nothing particularly complicated going on. And we've seen actually some of the most severe impacts. Three hurricanes of Category 4 or more hitting the U.S., and of course many other hurricanes. We've seen droughts. We've got the largest forest fire in California state history ongoing. I mean, it's just tragic. And the sad thing is that millions of lives have been impacted in the U.S. and abroad. And also we've seen, tragically, thousands of lives lost across the planet from these extreme weather events. So it really has been a particularly difficult year.
Yes, I can remember when I was following climate change in the 1990s, scientists talked about a very gradual warming. It was going to take a long time. But instead of a sloping graph, it seems like everything has been disturbed. Obama's White House science advisor, John Holdren, said we should forget about global warming and use climate disruption. What do you think?
I don't know. Whatever you call it, the fact is that the data shows. I mean, we are progressively, the planet is getting warmer, and it is accelerating beyond some of our, you know, conservative estimates, and even close to the most extreme. I think, as I say, this year, given that it was supposedly a year without some of the disruption, it's just startling to see. You know, we've had the highest temperatures ever recorded in the U.S. in Nevada. You know, we've had major heat waves. It's been it's going to be one of the top years for temperature. And we're continuing in that direction. I think that the main thing is we need to focus on what are the solutions. We need to look at what are the major factors here and what we can address quickly. And from our standpoint, from Rainforest Trust, we wish that more people would identify and see that actually rainforest destruction is a significant factor in carbon emissions. And actually it is absolutely, without doubt, the easiest one to address right now and for very cost-effective solutions.
For a couple of years there was some news that the Amazon deforestation had been slowed and somehow. Has the retreat of tropical rainforests been contained?
Absolutely not. If anything, it's accelerated, I'm afraid, Alex. We've seen at the moment for many, many years, it's averaged approximately 25 million acres of tropical forest being clear-cut every year. And that's not even factoring in degradation and other impacts, which are going on as we speak. This area is the size of the state of Virginia, and often referred to the size of Wales in the UK. These areas are incredibly important. You know, it's our most precious habitat in terms of flora and fauna. To the broader public, it's known as the lungs of the planet. And so having this loss continue to go on, it's not abating. And sadly, it's in some areas, it's accelerating. For example, we see now in Colombia, a country that's just gone through a 50-year insurgency war, coming into prosperity and peace at last, and deforestation is jumping to 40% a year-on-year increase. And this is tragic. It really is something that we should have got our arms around by now.
Paul, you have been a champion of the birds. What is the status of birds as they experience both loss of habitat and climate disruption?
Yes, I mean, I had a scientific paper published on that impact on climate change for birds in the Andes of South America. And it's clear that there are very serious consequences for many species, particularly on those that are on the higher parts of mountains that have very few options in terms of moving up in elevation. And also because degradation and deforestation is basically limiting options in terms of movement. So really there's a major impact on birds in the coming decades. But really some of the most some of the biggest impacts are actually going to be felt on amphibians that are very sensitive to whether it be stream temperatures. You know, a small opening in the forest can change the temperature of a river and or a stream and actually directly impact amphibians. And we're seeing, obviously, chytrid fungi on amphibians across the particularly South America, Central America, that's impacting. And increasingly, as we get more information on plants and other groups, and that's something that Rainforest Trust focuses on. We don't just look at the mega charismatic megafauna. We're looking actually some of our biggest interests are the critters that are overlooked. It's amphibians, plants, and invertebrates. So these are the things that we really need to keep an eye out for especially.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you are doing that. I was tempted to skip over your fourth top story of 2017, which you called Overturned Wildlife Protections. Do laws to protect wildlife really work?
Absolutely. The Endangered Species Act is absolutely spectacular. No country has anything similar to that, or at least is enforced as well as the U.S. It really is exceptional. I think that the fact that some of those legislations are being watered down or even overturned is of concern in the present administration. But as I say, at the end of the day, the U.S. is a champion on the environment at the state level, local level, and a lot of good stuff is still going on. I think that our worries about, for example, we've seen in recent months a couple of the national monuments, in fact, not just a couple, 10 national monuments being impacted, seriously degraded. Bears Ears National Monument losing 83% of its area has been lost in the last month through the change in legislation. So there's lots of unfortunate things we're seeing. But I think overall, wildlife protection continues to be pretty robust in the U.S. Our bigger concerns is really international, particularly with the ivory trade. Pangolins continue to be the most trafficked species, things like that.
Our final story in 2017 and what the Rainforest Trust promises is a new annual environmental year in review. It's really the big one, and this is what I think could kill off the rich bounty of our world. It's unsustainable fossil fuel dependency. A decade ago, fossil fuels were declared unsustainable because they would run out, peak oil, but that has not happened yet. Paul, has the climate threat overtaken peak oil as the driver of why we have to get off fossil fuels?
I think so, actually. You know, it's very interesting. I was asked a question a couple of days ago whether just because we're in prosperous times, people are worried about the environment. And, you know, we saw a real revolution with corporates and companies across the planet in the dark days of 2008, 2009 depression and governments going under and things like that. Actually, the environment actually stayed on top, and it's good for business. It's actually, you know, at the end of the day, you know, being more efficient and using less resources, maybe not heating your offices to such high temperatures or using so much paper, things like that, actually is good for business. And we've really seen that companies continue that drive towards sustainability. And, of course, fossil fuel dependency, we've seen amazing challenges or statements come out of major car companies this year on, you know, by 2040, or they're going to be all electric cars. And I mean, these are the sort of bold moves by companies and, of course, by individuals that are really going to keep us moving in this direction. And it certainly gives me hope.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is a prized scientist and conservationist, Dr. Paul Salomon, from the Rainforest Trust. With so many stories, Paul, of environmental disasters in 2017, and some big governments at least in failure mode, there are people out there who think we're just going to have to give up. What do you think?
Well, we've only got one planet. You know, the last time we sent someone to the moon, which is only, you know, just orbiting around us, was when I was just a few years old, back in the early 70s. And so I say, well, you're giving up on the planet. You're giving up on future generations. You're giving up on your own, you know, children's future or your friend's future. It's just not acceptable. We have to do better. And we are doing better, but we can do more. And so don't give up hope. Let's work together. I think that there's a lot of really positive things happening these days.
You started saving natural habitats when very young. Realistically, beyond sending a check to our environmental charities, which we should do, what can we as simple citizens do to help nature cope?
Well, the truth is there's lots of things. You can see our environmental year in review on our website at rainforesttrust.org, and we have actually some suggested resolutions on ways that us as the listeners can sort of take some ideas and implement them. I mean, there's a lot of simple things. I mean, this year there was a campaign over plastic straws. We realize 500 million plastic straws are used in restaurants every day in the U.S. I mean, that's incredible waste. I mean, we can just sip from a glass, right? There's certainly really major advances in awareness, and I think that the main thing is to continue to have hope, look at obviously there's recycling and lots of things that we're well aware of now, but there's lots of innovative ideas out there that can make your life much more sustainable and harmonious with the planet.
My friends at the Canadian-based charity Canopy are working away with major clothing brands and Chinese viscose producers to make it clear where that fiber comes from, to tell us what forests have been cut down for fashion clothes. How can we extend the know your source mantra that's in your report much further?
In Europe, there's much better labeling of products to know what's in there. One of the biggest drivers of deforestation at the moment, particularly in Southeast Asia, is oil palm. And it's really disappointing to see the variety of labeling on products that use it that try to hide it as like vegetable oil or things like this. And so better labeling is really essential. It's not just about, selecting your product. It's about just knowing what's going into your body. It's really important from a health perspective to know that we're eating the right things. And I think that becomes increasingly important. So good labeling is really essential.
And I read those labels because there's some incredible chemicals in some of our food that should not be there. Now, I'm experimenting with geothermal heat for a greenhouse in cold Canada. But at every step, Paul, it seems I need to buy more stuff. And I worry that even conversion to clean energy sources may kick this planetary climate even further off base. Can you talk to us about how we can manage consumption?
Yeah, no, that's very true. It's like, for example, you want to get a hybrid car, you want to give up your gasoline car for a hybrid or an electric. Well, the truth is that a lot of energy and resources went in to produce that new car. And actually, it turns out sometimes it may be better to run that small, compact, gasoline car and petrol car than it is to actually switch over to electric. But though ultimately, we need to do this. So it is a real challenge knowing what is the right approach. I think that ultimately, governments and companies are starting to move strongly in that direction. It just makes sense from a business perspective, and we should encourage it. When we have the option to get solar or wind energy, we should embrace it. And I think they're the sort of actions that each one of us can take. I know that not everywhere has the choice. Not everyone has the opportunity to put in a geothermal system, which is extremely expensive. But as technology develops, it will become more cheaper and hopefully much easier to put in.
Another solution in your annual review is a simple resolution for 2018, go outdoors. Why does that matter, Paul?
We need to connect with nature. I think that's one of the – when you appreciate the world around you, when you appreciate that habitats and wild areas give life on Earth, I think you'll have an understanding of why it's important to protect it and maintain it. And so that's why we say at a time when there's so many distractions – to stay indoors or stay in the mall or wherever, I think it's time. You know, we also need to make time to get out and enjoy nature. I'm very fortunate. Our office is in the Piedmont of Northern Virginia. It's a beautiful landscape, very close to Shenandoah National Park. We love it. It's a great place to be, and it inspires us. And I know that when people go out, enjoy nature. It's inspirational. It's refreshing. It's a stress reliever. And we need to do it more.
And I have to admit, in 2017, I did fail your last resolution to stay positive, and that's still one of my hopes for 2018. So what can we do to maintain our sanity during what looks like an ecological collapse, or is that question itself too negative?
That's too negative. Look, it is a pivotal moment. There's no doubt about it that the coming years will really be extremely influential in how we shape our future planet. Some say it's too late. I disagree. I think that actually, as we learn more, there is a tremendous amount of resilience on our planet, the species, across nature, and within humans. And so we just have to continue on. We need to stay positive. And I know that there's things going on, a crisis in the leadership in the U.S. and on the environmental front. These things, I think at the end of the day, it's an individual. It comes down to communities and cities that make the decisions. You know, even in areas that are very challenged, maybe in, you know, like coal-producing areas, they're turning to renewable energy. They've got wind farms. They are embracing technology. There is hope. So I say, please stay positive.
Do you think the call or just the sight of a single bird or a flock of birds can help lift us up?
Absolutely. It does for me. I know that there's lots of other people when they see a bird, they marvel. Unfortunately, there's too many that just pass over. You have selective vision, and I think that we need to open our eyes. And when we see a flock of geese flying overhead, or a chickadee, or a robin, it's just wonderful to just take pause for a second and enjoy those moments.
Yes, take the time. There is a message there. Why did the Rainforest Trust decide to create an annual environmental year in review?
Alex, that's a very good question. Well, firstly, there is none. No one's ever produced an environmental year in review. We were kind of surprised when we were looking up who was summarizing this kind of information. And we thought, well, why not do it? It's been a year of really tremendous environmental impact. And as Rainforest Trust, a collection of esteemed scientists and environmental conservationists, we thought it was great to come together, put together this information, and really give it to the public. Well, we focus on work across the tropics. The truth is that the issues are much bigger. It affects the whole planet, and what goes on in the U.S., in Europe, in Canada, really does influence significantly the whole planet. And one of the things that we really wanted to highlight, Alex, was the fact that massive loss of tropical forests are being overlooked, as we discussed, but really that they are incredibly important for their carbon dioxide emissions when deforested, and that just stopping deforestation will actually significantly reduce carbon dioxide emissions by a fifth. And also the chance to regenerate these areas will actually capture up to half of all of the emissions. And so we can really, part of the solution that we're facing is actually a large chunk of it is in the tropics. And when we're saving acres for as little as $2 to permanently save an acre of rainforest, that's not so expensive. In fact, you think of what an electric car costs, you can save hundreds, thousands of acres. It really is important.
So what does the Rainforest Trust do?
Well, the Rainforest Trust, we're just entering our 30th anniversary. For the last 30 years, we've stuck to our clear mission of purchasing and protecting tropical forests for endangered species. And we do that with local organizations, indigenous communities, local communities that we provide technical support, know-how, strategically identify the most important areas for these endangered species, and we work to protect them, provide them the resources. And we continue over the years to support those areas to make sure that they're sustainable and that they're going to be there for the future. That's our work.
Well, as we wrap up, I want to ask you a hard question. Can you really see a future where things get better instead of worse?
Yes. Unfortunately, to be realistic, it will get a bit worse before it gets better. That's the truth. However, I am confident that it will get better, and it's not so far away. I think we are turning a corner. I know we've had some bumps in the road, but we are turning a corner, and I can see that awareness is really growing. I can tell you this firsthand, because when you go out to poor rural communities across the tropics, when you get to some of the most isolated peoples, they know the climate is changing. They know more than most people in well-educated countries, and they feel it, and they know they have to change. And to see that gives me hope, because often they don't need to be convinced. They're actually asking just for the support on how to do it. And so that really gives hope, and I'm sure in the future things will get better.
We have been talking with the world-known scientist and conservationist Dr. Paul Salomon. Dr. Salomon is the chief executive officer of the Rainforest Trust. You can find more links to his work in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Paul, thank you so much for sharing with us on Radio EcoShock.
It was wonderful to be on Radio EcoShock with you, Alex. Thank you so much.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Here is an incredible twist to living in a hotter world. If you experienced heat stress in the womb or as a baby, your earnings could be lower 30 years later. Not possible, you say? Listen to this. Dr. Maya Rosten-Slater is a fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research and assistant professor of health and research and policy at Stanford University School of Medicine. She is co-author of a new paper, Relationship Between Season of Birth, Temperature Exposure, and Later Life Well-Being. That was just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Maya Rosten-Slater, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this study comes at global warming from a very odd angle. Who was it that wondered about the long-term impacts of heat? What is the history and the motivation of this paper?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there's two strands of literature, two strands of evidence that motivate this paper. So first is that there's this growing interest in trying to understand how factors in the very early life, including, you know, in the fetal stage, in utero stage, affect outcomes throughout the life cycle for people. And there's a growing body of evidence across disciplines. I'm an economist by training, so there's been a lot of attention to this in the economics literature, but also in epidemiology, in the medical literature, sociology, and so on, trying to understand how a variety of different environmental, health, nutrition, economic factors affecting people in the in utero period, as well as at the very early life, so the first few years of life, could have these really lasting long-term consequences on later economic, health, educational outcomes. And so, you know, we were motivated to look at temperature in particular, extreme heat, in part because there's already evidence that, you know, other types of environmental factors have these long-term consequences. So, for instance, I've done some work looking at the effects of air pollution exposure in the early life period and finding that it has long-term adverse consequences for people's later outcomes. You know, people have looked at other factors like natural disasters, lead, water pollution, and so on.
Radiation, too.
Yeah, and radiation is a very big one as well. Now, maybe temperature seems kind of a milder environmental factor, perhaps. But, you know, there's already evidence from other studies, not ours, showing that exposure to extreme heat during pregnancy can lead to lower birth weight and even increased infant mortality. So there's some evidence out there that suggests that exposure to extreme heat could have adverse consequences on early life health. So then that begs the question of, well, are there long-term consequences as well, especially given what we know about the fetal period as well as the, you know, early, the first couple years of life being so important for impacting longer outcomes. And then I think the second motivation for the study was, you know, thinking broadly about issues related to climate change and thinking broadly about issues related to the projection that we're supposed to be experiencing more and more days with extreme temperature, in particular extreme heat, you know, by the end of the century. And most of the research about topics related to climate change, you know, tries to think about the costs and benefits associated with these projected increases, sort of in the relatively immediate term, right? So trying to understand, for instance, again, I'm an economist, so there's studies looking at how exposure to extreme temperatures affects productivity among the workforce. And so, you know, and so then that obviously has implications for GDP and per capita income and so on. We're trying to take a kind of a more nuanced but perhaps longer-term approach in trying to understand, well, yes, we know that there could be effects kind of contemporaneously, so immediately, on these economic outcomes. But is it possible that there could also be longer-term consequences operating through this most intergenerational channel? And so that's kind of another motivation for the study, is trying to think, well, if we want to really have a good understanding of what are the costs and benefits associated with climate change, as well as policies trying to address climate change, you know, this is another factor that we should be putting into those calculations.
Okay. Now, in this research, how did you show there is a link between early heat and later earnings?
Yeah. So in order to be able to try to do something like that, you actually need quite a lot of data. And so we were fortunate in that we've been working with this database called the Longitudinal Employer Household Dynamic Database. So what it is it essentially contains information on people's earnings, so quarterly level earnings data, and it's linked to information on individuals' counties and exact dates of birth. Okay, so what that enables us to do is it allows us to link to very detailed weather data that's at the daily level. So we're able to measure for any given person that's born on any given date in a particular county, what's their exposure to different temperatures during, you know, 9 months before their date of birth and, say, during the first year of life. You know, so we can calculate how many days during the 9 months before your date of birth did you have a temperature that was on average higher than, say, 90 degrees Fahrenheit, okay? So we first create this linkage. And then, of course, we don't want to just be comparing people that are exposed to more hot days to other people who are exposed to fewer hot days, because you know, there's a lot of differences between people, say, living in very hot climates in the U.S. and people living in cooler climates in the U.S., right? There's a lot of geographic differences. There's a lot of things that are unrelated completely to temperature. So in order to be able to sort of separate causation from correlation, in order to be able to hone in on the specific effect of exposure to extreme heat, what we do is the following. We compare only people born within the same county, okay? So we're never comparing across geographic areas. We're looking at people born within the same county. And in fact, people born on the exact same day of the year, right? So as a thought experiment, you could imagine taking some county. Let's say, this is again just an example, let's say we take Harris County, Texas, and we're going to compare two people, person A and person B. They're both born on the exact same day of the year. So let's say they're both born on February 5th, but they're born in different years. So one is born in 1970 and one is born in 1971. And it just so happens that there is a large heat wave in this county during 1971 and not during 1970, okay? And so what that's going to mean is that these two people that are born in the same county on the exact same day of the year, but just the different years that happen to have where one has a heat wave and one doesn't, are going to be exposed to different numbers of high temperature days, okay? We're also, in addition to just looking at people born in the same county and on the exact same day of the year, we're also looking only at people, comparing people within race and within gender. Okay, so we're not looking sort of across race or across gender. We're looking at people of the same race and of the same gender, at least as recorded in our data, or in the exact same county and on the exact same day of the year. and comparing their exposure to different temperatures. And we're also, on top of that, you know, because we're using nearly 10 years of data or nearly 10 cohorts of individuals, so we want to account for the fact that people born in 1970 just experienced different trends and economic outcomes and so on from people, say, born in 1977 overall. So we're also controlling for overall trends over this time period. So that's kind of the best that we can do with our data to try to say something, you know, very specific and precise and causal about the effect of exposure to heat. But of course, you know, we didn't run a randomized experiment where, you know, we randomly assigned some people to have a lot of hot days and other people to not have hot days. So we can never be 100% sure that this is, you know, purely causal, but we think that we're doing a pretty good job. One last thing that I'll say about this, unless you want me to say more, is that, you know, one of our findings that we think is important and interesting is that exposure to air conditioning is mitigating nearly all of the effects of exposure to extreme heat. So if you thought this was something else was going on, right, so if you thought that this wasn't about heat and this was just we're picking up some differences that are just related to heat, that are about something else, then there would be no reason to think that air conditioning would play a role in it. So I think the fact that we're finding that air conditioning, which can, you know, is something that can be used to combat exposure to extreme heat, is actually mitigating our effect, is reassuring us that we are estimating something about exposure to heat.
Well, just one quick question from that. How could you possibly know how many people had air conditioning in the 1970s?
Excellent question. So actually, the U.S. Census, the decennial census, has information at the county level on what fraction of households had air conditioning. So they record this information in the census years. So we don't, so I should be more careful in explaining the research design. So in our data, right, we know we have individual level data where we observe people's earnings around age 30, and then we know their date of birth and their county of birth. We don't know in our data whether that person, any given individual, had air conditioning in their home when they were born. But we know that, again, going back to that example of Harris County, Texas, we know approximately what fraction of households in Harris County, Texas, had air conditioning in 1970 as well as in 1980, okay? And so that allows us to compare, basically, people who were born in counties that had high share air conditioning adoption versus people born in counties that had lower shares of air conditioning adoption and see whether the effect of temperature differs across those places.
Well, unfortunately, Maya, this study vindicates air conditioning. It appears that any woman expecting pregnancy should have AC during high heat. But if everyone everywhere gets air conditioning, then we get the power demands from fossil fuel, and that makes the outdoors hotter and hotter, makes climate change worse. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with what you said. I don't think that the takeaway of our study is, you know, all pregnant women should go run into air conditioning, although perhaps you could read it that way. I think the takeaways are a little bit more nuanced and sort of you have to think about it kind of the full picture as you suggest. So with air conditioning, as you say, it's not free in any way, right? It's not free from an individual level. You have to pay to install air conditioning in your household. And of course, it has all kinds of environmental costs as well. So to the extent that we're trying to do cost-benefit analyses to think about policies that try to address climate change, you know, the lot of different proposals, we have to take into account not just the direct effects of exposure to extreme heat, right? So we're offering some evidence on what's the direct effect of exposure to extreme heat in utero on long-term earnings outcomes, but also to try to understand what are the costs of any potential adaptation responses. Okay, so this is anything that people do to try to avoid exposure to any harmful effects of extreme temperatures. In our particular context, we're looking at air conditioning, which you can think about being as a costly technology that people can adopt in order to mitigate these effects. But we have to, any cost-benefit calculation has to take into account what are the costs associated with people using these technologies. And so I think that's sort of the bigger takeaway from the study. I think a related issue with regard to air conditioning is the fact that, you know, this study is based in the United States. When people look at this, they say, okay, but pretty much everybody has air conditioning these days, although, of course, not everybody. But, you know, a good share of households in the United States, especially in hotter climates, have air conditioning. So is this really that big of a deal? As you point out, you know, there's some environmental costs associated with air conditioning. But also, if we take a more global perspective, you know, countries that have some of the hottest climates in the world actually don't have that much air conditioning. So we're thinking about global inequality, global consequences of climate change. You know, this is one mechanism by which inequality could actually grow if we think about the differences between developing and more developed countries. You know, hotter there's a lot of research trying to link climate to development, and we're sort of honing in on one mechanism, which is this intergenerational component of having exposure in either the in utero or early childhood stage on long-term earnings, which is also correlated with productivity and labor force participation. So if we're thinking about ways to address global inequality, ways to address differing impacts of climate change across different nations in the world, understanding how these effects interact with technologies that exist, such as air conditioning, and that exist differentially across different countries, is important.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Maya Rawson-Slater. We're talking about the impact of heat stress in the womb and on toddlers showing up in lower earnings decades later. She is a research fellow with several organizations. I guess, Maya, I could call you a kind of public health economist. Would that be accurate?
Yes, that's actually a pretty good title. I'm interested in both health economics and public economics and the intersection of those two.
Given this new study results, is it possible we could raise the standard of living simply by providing optimum conditions for pregnancy and the first year of life?
That's a big question. You know, I've done some other work on, you know, not just temperature, but a variety of other public interventions targeting the very early childhood period. I'm not by any means the only one that has done this work. There's now a growing body of evidence, in many ways pioneered by people like James Heckman, Nobel laureate economist in Chicago, focusing on the importance of investing in the early childhood period. So I'm definitely, you know, my own work and the work of many others does suggest that intervening with public policies that try to, as you say, create optimal conditions, whether it's during pregnancy or in the first, let's say, 5 years of life, could have really huge returns in terms of improving outcomes of the next generation. So I'm very much sympathetic to policies that do target this period. But I also want to caution against, you know, sort of using a one-size-fits-all approach and saying, okay, we're only going to focus on this period if we're only going to invest in this period and we're sort of going to ignore other periods in life. I think there's still a lot of evidence showing that, the other thing I'll say is that one common misunderstanding of this line of work is that it's to suggest that this means that if you sort of don't intervene in that period, you kind of missed out, and then it's like a lost cause. And I think that's a pretty terrible and depressing misunderstanding because, you know, kids are quite resilient. There's a lot of evidence saying that. So even if you don't have optimal pregnancy conditions, or if you have stress, or if you have very high temperatures, or if you have exposure to other kinds of negative shocks, you know, it turns out that intervening in later life, it turns out that, you know, supporting people as they go through schooling, supporting their health through access to health insurance throughout their childhood and adulthood is also very important. So I will say that I, in general, believe and think the evidence supports investing resources into policies that target the early childhood period as well as the pregnant women. But I also think that not all is lost. So for any listeners that, you know, think about their own life or think about their own pregnancy, let's say, and think, oh, wow, I didn't have the most optimal conditions. Am I doomed? I hope that the takeaway message is that, no, you're not, and that there's a lot of other interventions that can occur and a lot of resilience that we observe.
Your study's based on averages and statistics, aren't they? I mean, that doesn't mean to say that one of those hot kids from Harris County might not turn out to be Bill Gates or Carl Sagan.
Exactly. And also, you should remember that our effects are quite small when we look at the individual level, right? So what we're finding is having one more day of very hot temperatures, so above 32 degrees Celsius or, you know, about 90 degrees Fahrenheit on average. This is mean temperature. This is not the max mean temperature day. Having one more of those during pregnancy reduces annual earnings at age 30 by about $30, right? So $30 on an annual basis is not a very huge amount. So even if you calculate sort of the lifetime earnings loss associated with us, with that, it's still not a very large amount. So our point is not to say that at the individual level, you know, having exposure to extreme heat is really, really bad. You know, in terms of things to worry about during pregnancy in the early childhood stage, extreme heat should not be at the forefront of people's worries. But our point is to say, okay, maybe at an individual level, this effect is not that big. But if we're trying to, again, going back to trying to understand consequences of climate change, well, we have to scale that number up by the number of people who are exposed to these extreme temperatures, how that's going to change by the end of the century. And then, you know, pretty quickly you get actually much bigger numbers.
Maya, does this give a slight advantage to people in cooler states like the Northeast versus those in the U.S. Southwest or the traditional South? Please talk to us about the regional differences emerging out of your study.
Yeah, so I think we have to be careful in terms of drawing conclusions about regional differences. As I said, first of all, our research design is explicitly not comparing across regions, right? We're comparing only within geographic areas, small geographic areas, meaning counties. And one sort of conceptual reason that we actually do that, in addition to trying to better understand the causality, but it's also there's some evidence that suggests that, you know, people can adapt to hot climates. So part of what we're actually identifying is exposure to very unusually hot days, right? So the example that I was sort of bringing up before, well, you know, we're looking at people born in the same county, but one happened to have been in utero during an extreme heat wave and one not, right? So it's not so much that on average in the Northeast, temperatures are cooler than in the South, right? But it's about, you know, what's the chance that you are used to or your, you know, people in your locality are used to relatively cool temperatures all the time. And then suddenly you're hit with an extreme heat wave versus you're used to pretty hot temperatures all the time, but you don't really have that many heat waves, right? So it's sort of different questions. A little bit. So I don't think our results can really speak to understanding regional differences in outcomes. I think there's a lot of other factors that account for regional differences that are not related to temperature.
But you mentioned other countries, and I guess this is a human trait, not just a cultural trait. Would I be right in thinking that?
Sure. Yeah. So I mentioned other countries in part to sort of give a framework for thinking about, you know, why it matters whether or not we have access to air conditioning, right? In part to sort of motivate that there's many other countries that actually have a lot of heat waves or a lot of hot days but don't have air conditioning. And there is actually, you know, there is some research that's trying to understand differences across countries in productivity and GDP growth and so on, and trying to relate them to climate. It's, you know, as you can imagine, and as I sort of hinted at in talking about the regional differences, it's really hard to draw those links in a super precise way because, you know, there's just so many differences across countries, right? That it's really hard to isolate, you know, what is happening due to climate or temperature in particular versus all kinds of institutional differences, cultural differences, and so on. And so that's why I'm a little bit hesitant to draw very concrete conclusions about differences across regions. But you know, you could imagine that maybe temperature does play a role in explaining a little bit of the variation across regions in, say, average earnings or average labor market outcomes. We just don't have any very good evidence on that. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. This kind of ties into an interview I did a few weeks ago with Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii, and he was talking about research into heat deaths and why people die from heat. And he talked about organ damage that could take years or decades to show up later. And that sounds a little bit like what we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think there's this growing interest, and I mean, now for several decades, actually, but into trying to understand kind of latent effects of shocks, of health shocks. And so, you know, in talking about what are the very long-term consequences of exposure to extreme heat in the early life stage, we relate to something called the fetal origins hypothesis, which is this idea that was first put forth by David Barker, a physician, in the early 1990s, that suggests that conditions in the very early life period, and actually in utero stage, could have long-term consequences 50, 60, 70 years later that don't actually appear till then. And he was talking about health shocks. He was talking about disease prevalence. You know, you could think about it more broadly in that if there are these latent consequences from health shocks at one point in life that don't appear until much, much later, it can have effects on all kinds of outcomes that are not just health, but also economic productivity, labor market attachment, and so on.
Wow. It seems like this study is part of a whole new range in public health research as the planet warms into more extreme heat waves. Maya, where do you think this can go, and what will you be working on next?
So I think it's definitely, there's a lot of, as the planet changes and as research evolves, there's a lot of exciting new research questions that can hopefully be studied with newly emerging data and inform public policy, both in the United States, which is where I'm based, as well as around the world. I'm continuing in the same research area, so I'm working on issues related to other types of public interventions in the early childhood period, so for instance, nurse home visiting programs and access to public preschools. So that's one line of work that I do. In terms of on the environmental side, as I mentioned, I have one study on air pollution that looks at the early childhood exposure in utero as well as first year of life exposure to air pollution. And again, impacts on earnings around age 30. And then I look at other policies that target the same life stage, such as paid family leave in the United States, as well as in other countries as well.
I did an interview about 8 years ago about the impact of pollution on children in the womb, where pregnant mothers wore these backpacks around Harlem, which recorded everything that they were breathing, and were able to show that there was actual changes, I believe, to the DNA from pollution. So that's another huge topic we could talk about maybe another time.
Yeah, no, that's very important and definitely relates to some of my research. That sounds great.
I'll send you a link to that. From the Stanford University School of Medicine, we've been speaking with Dr. Maya Rosten-Slater. She's co-authored a new paper published December 4th, 2017 in PNAS. The title is Relationship Between Season of Birth, Temperature Exposure, and Later Life Well-Being. Find links in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Maya, thank you so much for sharing your time with all of us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's all the time we have for Radio EcoShock this week. I am back under protest, and I trust that protest will spread as humans realize we have destabilized the ecosphere. This isn't a debate or reality TV or entertainment. It is science and the daily reality we all experience. I've got some great guests coming up, including tools you can use. And don't forget, you can listen to or download all our past programs going back 11 years at my website at ecoshock.org. A full education on climate change, tropical forests, coral, and much more is just waiting for you, free of charge, from the leading scientists, authors, and activists from around the world at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Stay tuned.
Hi everyone, it's May with 350.org with a short end of the year message for you. 2017 was definitely a challenging year for the climate movement, for people impacted by climate change, and for our sister movements. But despite all of that, there were some things that happened that we can be proud of. In April, the People's Climate March brought hundreds of thousands of people to Washington, D.C., calling for climate justice, and it was a collaboration of hundreds of different organizations. Then there was the global divestment mobilization with over 260 events in 45 countries calling on institutions to divest from fossil fuels. And then quite recently at the UN Climate Talks, COP23, there were impressive efforts to call for a coal phase out in Germany, to hold the Trump administration to account, and to support the Pacific Climate Warriors Have Your Say declaration. We were also celebrating the cancellation of the Energy East tar sands pipeline, over 350 municipalities in Brazil having banned fracking. And just a few days ago, the pension funds of New York City and New York State, worth over $390 billion, have made a really impressive divestment commitment after years of fighting. So we are looking forward to 2018. And among the highlights that we are looking to, we're going to continue to battle the Keystone XL pipeline always, through the Promise to Protect and Solar XL. We'll be working to halt new coal development in Africa through the Decolonize Africa campaign. And in September, there will be a global climate action summit hosted by Governor Jerry Brown, my home state of California, calling on subnational governments to make ambitious new climate commitments. We'll also be engaging with communities all across the country calling for fossil-free resolutions, and we hope you will be one of them. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
That the first intifada created in the first 2-3 weeks through the way how the people they organized, they were a leaflet coming by the unified leadership, and this is something achieved in the Palestinian history.
It always awakens nostalgia in many of us, even though we didn't live through that period.
Palestinian collective action gave everyone a sense of hope.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and this is the Electronic Intifada podcast. Today, we take a look back at the first Intifada, which began in December 1987. We'll hear from two journalists, Ziad Abbas from Dehesha refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, who was working as a reporter when the uprising began, and Badr Hassan in Jerusalem, who grew up in the wake of the first Intifada. And we'll hear from Jennifer Bing, who was working in Ramallah as a teacher during that period, and now says she is witnessing an Intifada of sorts in the halls of the U.S. Congress. Let's begin with Ziad Abbas of the Middle East Children's Alliance. This is part of a longer interview that you can hear in full on our SoundCloud page. Listen to this.
My name is Ziad Abbas Shamrukh. I was born and grew up in the Dehesha refugee camp. My family uprooted from two villages, actually. My dad is from Zakaria village, and my mom is from Jerash village. And they were uprooted in 1948, and they came to the Dehesha refugee camp. And since that time until now, my family is still living in the refugee camp. I'm working with Middle East Children's Alliance, MECCA, based in Berkeley. And I am still part of my work. It's connected to our community in Palestine or other communities in Syria, Lebanon, and in the Middle East in general. In 1987, I was in the Dehesha refugee camp, and when the Intifada was started in the beginning of December, it wasn't something new for us in the Dehesha refugee camp, because I remember that since I become like almost I was 15 years, this is part of our daily activities in the Dehesha refugee camp. And here I am speaking about late 70s. There are many incidents happened in our refugee camp since that period. And I can say it wasn't something new for the people in our refugee camp, because there are certain kind of measures the Israelis, they took and they did in our refugee camp long time, even 10 years before the first intifada. For example, the curfew issue, almost we experienced that since we were children, and sometimes we spent long time and under curfew, sometimes 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and this is end of 70s, beginning of 80s, and until the first intifada started. The second thing that, the second measure that the Israel, they took, it was closing all the entrances in our refugee camp, and it was in 1979. I remember that very well, when they blocked and sealed all the entrances by rocks, and some entrances it was by concrete, blocking, and it wasn't possible for us to cross from the camp to the main street. And here I want to describe for the people in the bus that the Hesha camp, the location of the Hesha camp, it's on the main road between Jerusalem and Hebron. So everyone want to cross, coming from Jerusalem, cross Bethlehem, going to Hebron, need to pass in front. It's the only, the main road to Hebron. And there were a lot of activities in the camp where children and youth grew up, like throwing stones at the Israeli military cars, and sometimes they were throwing stones at the Israeli settlers' cars when they passed the settlements around Hebron. So by closing these kind of entrances, they blocked the movement of the people to cross the street. The second thing, the campaigns, the arrest campaigns, how many people they were experienced jails, and almost I can say most of the youth, our youth and children in the camp, they experienced the prison, some of them for 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, blah, blah, including me. I was a child. They took us as a children, and we were arrested. And at the same time, when you go to jail, you learn about new things, you meet other people, etc. So we were in November, actually, before December. And as usual, Israel is before certain kind of occasion, what they call it, preventive security measures. They impose curfew, and sometimes they arrest people before certain kind of national occasion where the people, they take the street, protest, organize demonstration, etc. So in November, we had two, in 1987, we had two main occasions. The first one, it's Balfour Declaration. It's November 2nd. So there were a curfew, and there were demonstration. Even the people, they break the curfew, and they go out to the street and they protest. And the second one, it was November 29th. It's the International Solidarity Day with the Palestine, with Palestinian. So the people we had our own occasion. And many people, the Israelis, they came to arrest many people in that period. They didn't find them in the houses. I know some friends, they were all the time prepared. Before any occasion, they prepared their bags to go to prison. They come take them, including my brother, actually. He used to do that. And later, I become the same. I was working as a journalist in that period, and it was the beginning for me to work as a journalist. At the same time, I'm living in the Hesha refugee camp. So in December, I was in the Hesha, and in that period, the Hesha, actually, we had a military camp, the Israeli military camp in front of the camp, where you have many military tents. Even they have a piece of land where the helicopters, sometimes they are landed, they come to our area, and you have military patrols all the time, and moving inside the camp, around the camp, 24 hours. So in that period, I can say the spirit, how the people in the refugee camp before the intifada started, as I said, we had our own intifada, but we have the community support to each other. Mm-hmm. For how they support each other sometimes, even when you want to cross the street, just you check with the people, they are in the roof or in the windows, do you know where are the soldiers, where you can pass? And usually this kind of military groups moving around the camp, they stop you, they search you, and sometimes they arrest you, and sometimes they beat you. It depends. And this is how the people, they were supporting each other. In that period too, the people, when they build a house, you find two gates to the house. Or sometimes you can enter the house, but most of the houses in the camp, they have a window open. Still, you can escape from the house, jump to other house. Or through the roof, you can jump from house to house to house. And this is what we call it, related to the Intifada culture, our own Intifada. The people, all the time, they're concerned that when youth from the camp, they are escaping from soldiers, they will have the chance to escape. If they enter the house, they know there is a window, they can escape from the other side of the house. And this is the culture of how we were growing up. But at the same time, we were supporting, they were the community, take care of each other, support, distributing food, sharing whatever you have, resources, etc. So when the Intifada started, it was like a car accident in Jabali refugee camp. And the reaction came immediately from other refugee camp, like Balata, and I remember in Nablus. And they were, I think his name, Ibrahim Laqliq, he was killed in that period, the second after the seven people, they were killed in Jabalia. And it was like a surprise in the way it's how the whole community reacting the first few days. So in our camp, it's a daily activities against the settlers, against the soldiers, where the people they were taking there. And I was working at the same time as a journalist, where I was reporting all the time. So the atmosphere, it was for us before the first Intifada, when they usually impose curfew or something happened inside the camp, usually youth, and especially our age, targeted. No matter if you throw stones or not, you are targeted. As young, as youth, all the time the soldiers, they target you. This is like, usually we used to escape from the refugee camp, where you go to Beit Jala, to Beit Lahem, to Beit Sahur, to Al Khadr, to the villages around, Battir. I remember we used to go to sleep in Battir groups, tens of youth go, and the community there prepared the food for us until the curfew, until ended, we returned back to the refugee camp. What happened with the first Intifada, you see the other location, other villages, other towns, they are involved. The feelings, the good feelings we had when we used to leave the camp and go outside where it's more secure to be in Beit Jala or Beit Sahur or in Battir or Al Khadr, the other villages around us, now it's not there anymore because there are activities there. There are soldiers, they are moving around, and everyone is targeted, especially in our generation. And I can say in the first Intifada, I was just 25 years old in that period. So for us, the other good feeling is we are not alone now. We are not just our refugee camp in the whole area involved in this national struggle. Now, almost every location. And we grew up with this. I can say I was a child, but later we grew up, and many people inside the camp, we become an expertise how to deal with the situation, how to organize, how to take care of each other. In different levels, health issue, education, care for you, how the community. So we were like an expertise in the whole area, where other areas, they were approach us to learn and to ask for certain kind of advices and how to organize. So it was amazing feeling. At the same time, the whole spirit, you feel high, to feel all your community involved in this issue. And of course, the number of the people increasing. I want to highlight a little bit here before the Intifada, in 1985. I said in 1979, they sealed all the entrances in the refugee camp. In 1985, they built the fence, the first part of the fence. Dehesha was known by the fence, the wall, or what they call it, the wall. So they had the fence. In the beginning of the first Intifada, immediately they continued the whole fence to isolate the camp from the main road, Jerusalem-Hebron road. In 21st, and this is, I remember this day very well, as a journalist, I was working as a journalist in the ground there, and this is like the first general strike in Palestine, where 1948 area, all the Palestinian community inside Israel, with West Bank and Gaza, they have the general strike. No one go to work, no one go to school, etc. And this is the first morning when we wake up in the Hesha refugee camp. It was very, very, very cold day. But suddenly we find part of the fence destroyed and fell down in the main street. So the Israeli army, even they have the military camp, but youth in the camp, they succeed to cut the fence and destroy part of the fence, not the whole fence. And immediately the response of the Israelis, they were like, I remember the shooting at morning, just for nothing. They were shooting everywhere. They were very angry, very upset. At the same time, it was a curfew too, and they start building the fence again, but this time they made the fence for the two tracks. It was one track, a fence, later, and a fence with barbed wire, etc. They add another track to make it difficult to be destroyed. And to make it, the holes in the fence very thin, so the youth in the camp, when they use the slingshot, still they cannot throw the stones through the holes, through the fence. This is our camp at that period. I remember it was, and even our family, we were living like our house, it was still very simple house, and it wasn't easy to feel secure, so all the time you need to change houses where you sleep. And sometimes you change, even we were working as a journalist, we were targeted, and especially journalists, we were targeted where we use, you need to change the house, and you need to go to move from house to house. It depends how the soldiers, they are moving inside the camp. And you can't sleep. You cannot have like 8 hours sleeping unless you are far from the camp. All the time, 2 hours, 3 hours, they wake you up, you move to other house. And all the houses, I can say most of the houses was open for us, where you can just relax or have some food or have a cigarette and move to other house.
Ziad Abbas talking about his experiences during the First Intifada, specifically in Dehesha refugee camp in the Bethlehem area in the occupied West Bank.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Maisha Braden of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who explains why her group has condemned the Trump Justice Department for rescinding critical legal guidance documents on important civil rights and other issues. Josh Hoxie of the Institute for Policy Studies, who summarizes his group's new report, which finds that America's top 25 billionaires have as much wealth as 56% of the U.S. population. And Noliwe Rooks, Director of American Studies at Cornell University, who talks about her new book titled Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
By mid-January, President Trump may have an opportunity to impose new sanctions on Iran that would derail the historic nuclear agreement signed by Iran, the U.S., European states, Russia, and China. Even as key members of Trump's national security team try to preserve the nuclear deal, Trump may opt to kill it. Last October, Trump refused to certify the agreement, citing Iran's actions in Syria and across the Middle East, which are not linked to the nuclear agreement. In recent days, the Trump administration has imposed new, largely symbolic sanctions against 25 Iranian companies and individuals, including the Quds Force of Iran's Revolutionary Guard. On January 11th, Trump faces another deadline to certify Iran's compliance with the nuclear deal. International inspectors report Iran continues to be in compliance with the agreement. But if Trump rejects the agreement, Congress has 60 days to reimpose sanctions. He can also decide not to renew a waiver that exempts Iran from sanctions. If he does so, Tehran will likely declare that the U.S. has breached the agreement and then could restart its nuclear program. Daryl Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association, worries that Trump's move to put the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem demonstrates his willingness to ignore the advice of his own national security team in favor of pleasing his right-wing political base. These decisions come at a sensitive moment for Iran, where thousands of protesters have taken to the streets to express their anger about a flagging economy, corruption, and rising fuel and food prices. United Nations child protection workers have been deployed to the border between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, looking for Haitian children who may be abandoned, trafficked, or separated from their families. The International Organization for Migration and Haiti's Child Welfare Agency operate a safe house run by a Catholic charity to temporarily house lost or abandoned children. According to the Miami Herald, thousands of children each year are trafficked in Haiti. Many fled abuse or were abandoned by their parents. In the safe house, children wait for parents to claim them. Otherwise, they are sent to live in an orphanage. Efforts to protect vulnerable children in Haiti were increased after a group of American missionaries were accused of kidnapping 33 children and attempting to take them out of the country in the aftermath of the deadly 2010 earthquake. Despite recent advancements in child protection, hundreds of thousands of children are exploited as domestic servants, with a significant number fleeing employers' homes or abusive families. Investors in private prisons were the big winners in the new Republican tax cut legislation that slashed tax rates for the wealthy and big corporations. At the same time, key middle-class benefits such as deductions for state and local taxes were scaled back. Under the new tax law signed by President Trump, real estate investment trusts, or REITs, will see a 25% tax cut. Two of the largest private prison companies, CoreCivic, which is formerly Corrections Corporation of America, and Geo Group, restructured as REITs in 2013. The two corporations operate over 80% of the private prison beds in the U.S. The Guardian newspaper reports that Geo Group and CoreCivic paid out over $430 million in dividends to investors in 2017, but with the new tax law, they could pay out an additional $50 million to stockholders. According to Lauren Brooke Eisen of the Brennan Center for Justice, prison companies have argued that renting out cells to the government is the equivalent of charging a tenant rent. The Geo Group donated $500,000 to Trump's inauguration committee and booked its annual meeting at a Trump resort in Miami. Soon thereafter, the company secured a lucrative government contract for an immigration detention center. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Toward the end of the Obama administration, the Justice Department issued 25 guidance documents to prosecutors, judges, and others involved in the criminal justice system to improve the administration of laws, including civil rights laws. Based on interpretations of the Constitution and legal precedent, the guidelines were put into practice in places like Ferguson, Missouri, New Orleans, Louisiana, and the states of Arkansas, Tennessee, and Alabama, in order to redress injustices, such as criminalizing people who owe civil fines. On December 22nd, President Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions withdrew these guidance documents, charging that they were creating new law and evading regulatory process. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law condemns Sessions' action, with the group's president and executive director, Kristen Clark, writing, quote, "We condemn Attorney General Sessions' latest attempt to turn back the clock on civil rights progress and urge courts and administrators across the country to take affirmative steps to halt the resurgence of unconstitutional debtors' prisons in their communities." Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Myesha Braden, director of the Criminal Justice Project with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, which was founded at the request of President John F. Kennedy and his brother, then Attorney General Robert Kennedy, to provide lawyers to those advocating for civil rights and the indigent. Here, Braden, who left the Justice Department after 15 years, explains why she believes that Sessions' Justice Department abdication of its responsibility creates a danger for all Americans.
I can speak specifically to the guidance that was revoked that related to criminal justice fines and fees. There were 25, some of them relate to civil rights, some of them don't. The fines and fees guidance sits squarely at the heart of our civil rights work and involves the 14th Amendment and the rights that people are entitled to due process and equal protection under the 14th Amendment. This guidance resulted following the Department of Justice's very detailed investigation into what was happening in Ferguson, Missouri. In the Ferguson investigation, the Department of Justice found that that municipality was using fines and fees not as a method of increasing or promoting public safety, but as a method of collecting revenue. People were being fined for things like jaywalking and expired tags and different really relatively minor misdemeanor offenses, and they were receiving substantial fines and fees that compounded as the payments were late. As a result of that, people were simply walking around Ferguson with warrants all over the place, and those warrants had a negative effect on those people's experience of citizenship. It had a negative effect on their employment opportunities, sometimes housing opportunities. And based on that report and what was found in that report, the Department of Justice issued guidance so that courts would understand, under a case called Bearden v. Georgia, the Supreme Court had found that the 14th Amendment prohibited the jailing of individuals without a consideration of their ability to pay debt. That's it. That's all the guidance did. It set out very clearly that the courts could not send people to jail for nonpayment of fines and fees unless the courts had first found that that nonpayment was willful. As a result of the Department of Justice's guidance letter, courts and municipalities in many places started to make changes, some of their own accord, some as a result of litigation that was brought, and some as a result of legislators understanding that there was a problem with fines and fees and trying to make changes within their states, and city council people trying to make changes within their cities. Department of Justice is responsible for establishing justice and promoting practices that ensure justice, fairness, and equality for all Americans. So this guidance document and the similar guidance documents that were revoked were simply the Justice Department implementing its full mission. To watch Attorney General Sessions roll back those things suggests that the Justice Department is operating at less than its full capacity, that the Justice Department is not interested in promoting justice, particularly as it relates to civil rights issues. And that can be seen, in addition to the pulling back of these guidance documents, to Attorney General Sessions' statements concerning consent decrees, how he disfavored them and intended to perhaps not use them at all, in addition to reversing positions on the use or the providing of military equipment to law enforcement, to suggesting that the Justice Department was not interested in looking at police misconduct and excessive use of force because of concerns about low morale for police officers and just avoiding all of the proof, all of the evidence, all of the data suggesting that those incidents of violence actually undermine the ability of law enforcement to do their job because it causes them to lose the trust of the communities that they're assigned to protect. Now, without this guidance from the Department of Justice and without the support of the Department of Justice for making these changes, it will be much harder to get jurisdictions to make changes of their own accord. And perhaps only litigation will be able to force that change. The power of a DOJ statement on the legality of a practice really cannot be understated.
Maisha Braden, is there anything that can be done to reverse this?
No, because it was a guidance document. The Attorney General has the prerogative to issue or not issue, to pull back or not. I wish they were being much more thoughtful rather than simply what appears to be rolling back everything that Attorney General Holder and President Obama did simply because they did it.
That was Maisha Braden, director of the Criminal Justice Project with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Learn more about the project and challenges to the Justice Department's action on civil rights issues by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. America has for many decades witnessed a steady rise in wealth inequality as incomes of the rich skyrocket and that of middle class and poor families have stagnated. While the United States is one of the richest countries in the world, it's also one of the most unequal. According to a report published by the World Economic Forum in 2017, the U.S. ranks 23 out of 30 developed nations in a measure known as the Inclusive Development Index, which factors in data on income, health, poverty, and sustainability. The unpopular new Republican tax reform legislation, recently signed into law by President Trump, will, according to many economists, exacerbate inequality further, with reductions in tax rates for wealthy individuals and corporations, at the same time cuts are made to critical social programs millions of Americans rely on. A recently published report titled Billionaire Bonanza 2017, The Forbes 400 and the Rest of Us, exposes the extreme wealth concentrated within the fortunes of the 400 wealthiest Americans and compares this wealth to the much more meager assets of several different segments of U.S. society. Your reporter spoke with Josh Hoxie, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Project on Opportunity and Taxation, who summarizes some of the important findings in this report that he co-authored with Chuck Collins.
This report looks at the Forbes 400, which Forbes magazine's been producing for a little over 30 years, their list of the 400 richest people, which is the best guess we have at how much money is really concentrated at the very tippity top of the economic spectrum. And I say best guess because there's so much money hiding in offshore tax shelters as recently has come to light that this is as much as we'll know. So these numbers are almost certainly worse than we have depicted here. And it compares those numbers to a survey the Federal Reserve puts out every 3 years called the Survey of Consumer Finances, which is a statistically representative picture of Americans' wealth and income and things of that nature. The report compares these two groups, and our findings are pretty bleak, and they've sort of been getting worse year after year, as this is the second time we've sort of done this. We did it last in 2015. So, you know, the full Forbes 400 list own as much as the bottom 64% of the U.S. population, which, to put that in context, 400 people in the United States have as much wealth as the entire GDP of Great Britain, which is an insane amount of money. Part of the disparity in the United States is that while there's so much wealth concentrating at the top, many, many people at the bottom are struggling. So we looked into what we're calling underwater nation, which is the population of people who are either at zero net worth or negative net worth, meaning they owe more money than they own in assets. And about one in five Americans fits into that category. Those numbers are deeply skewed by racial numbers. The proportion of Black and Latino families who are underwater is about double the proportion that white families are underwater as a result of, you know, decades of discrimination.
Josh, in this report, you talk about hereditary aristocracy of wealth and power that is now firmly in place in the United States. Tell us a little bit about the unfair economic policies that have played a role in rising income inequality that many conservative political activists ascribe to some kind of supernatural phenomenon or random set of outcomes. But there is a policy link to things that are decided in Washington, right?
Absolutely. And a lot of folks in this country who have done very well economically want to believe that they did it on their own. We have a recurring myth in this country of, you know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. And for a population of people, that's true, born into poverty and became rich. However, the United States has increasingly decreasing, which is a funny way to say it, more and more folks are struggling to get out of poverty. And the best indicator for how well you're going to do financially is how well your parents did financially. So on the one hand, like, sure, people do work hard and get ahead. On the other hand, plenty of people work just as hard and don't get ahead because of the lottery of their birth. So when we talk about inherited advantage, we're talking about that birth lottery, which is to say, you know, one example, how hard did Tiffany Trump work to become the wealthy heiress that she is, or Paris Hilton for that matter? And that's not to begrudge them their status. It's just to say that, you know, as far as the tax code is concerned, I just can't understand why we'd want to charge people taxes who punch a paycheck every week and not charge taxes to people who all they had to do was wait for their money because they won it in a genetic lottery. I mean, even lottery findings are taxed, so why wouldn't we tax the genetic lottery? It's sort of absurd if you think about it in those terms.
In line with other economists around the world, you observe that the levels of inequality that we see that are only skyrocketing are unsustainable both economically and politically. I wondered if you'd explain.
I think folks should really get a sense that this is not normal. I mean, what we're seeing right now of the concentration of wealth at the top has only really happened in the lead up to other not great things. I mean, the first Gilded Age led up to the Great Depression. We don't really want to see that again. So the breakup of wealth is going to happen one way or another. I hope it doesn't happen by war and depressions and things of that nature. There's a much less violent and more pleasant way to do it, to break up wealth, and it's pretty straightforward, taxing the rich and investing in economic opportunity for everyone in the country. But to your point, yeah, like we can't continue like this. I mean, there's only so much folks will accept, and as more wealth hides in offshore tax shelters, any semblance of truth to the idea that wealth is going to trickle down from the top just goes away. I mean, it's just not true. So instead, they find ways to buy, you know, a 10-foot longer yacht. I mean, really, what's the difference between a 190-foot yacht and a 197-foot yacht? But that's honestly the level of where our money is going in terms of how the very, very wealthy are spending their assets when they're not just watching it move up higher and higher on a computer screen.
That was Josh Hoxie, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Project on Opportunity and Taxation, and co-author, along with Chuck Collins, of the report titled Billionaire Bonanza 2017, The Forbes 400 and the Rest of Us. Find a link to the report and related analysis and commentary on rising inequality in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Randy Weingarten, who leads the 1.6 million member American Federation of Teachers Union, declared in August that President Trump's education secretary, Betsy DeVos, is the most ideological anti-public education person to ever be nominated or confirmed to that position. DeVos, who never attended public school or worked in one, has devoted her life to allowing parents to choose the schools their children attend, either charter or private schools using public funds, in decreasing the federal government's role in education. DeVos bankrolled a ballot measure in Michigan to create a public school voucher system that was soundly defeated by a 2-to-1 margin. She then spent millions of dollars of her own money to elect legislators who then made deep cuts to public school budgets and promoted unaccountable for-profit charter schools in the state. Now almost half of Michigan's charter schools rank near the bottom, and Michigan dropped from 28th to 41st in reading skills and from 27th to 42nd in math compared with other states. Your reporter spoke with No Lee Wei Rooks, Director of American Studies at Cornell University, who talks about her new book titled Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Here, Professor Rooks condemns school privatization efforts and contends that publicly funded schools are essential to quality, equal education for all and an indispensable element to build a democratic society.
Taxpayer-supported public education starts for the entire country. It had been in certain parts of the East Coast, in Massachusetts in particular, from the 1600s, but it's really post-Reconstruction that the rest of the country gets with the idea of, you know, we should use taxpayer dollars to educate all of our citizens, regardless of wealth, before 1890 to 1920, that period. You know, education was really something only for the very wealthy. It was mostly private. You know, people were sent to Europe. They were sent to private boarding schools in the U.S. And the idea of educating the masses of Americans really is a kind of quintessentially American intervention, that no matter who you are, no matter your social station, there's something about education that would be valuable for you. And this is a way that we can start to educate all Americans around what citizenship means, that we can define a particular kind of civic imagination and a goal of democracy, of what kinds of citizens we want to participate in this experiment in democracy where, you know, voters, where everyone, where citizens of the country are engaging in setting the policy and setting the direction. That was the ideal.
When we see the drive toward privatizing our education system in this country through charter schools, the movement towards school vouchers, the whole notion of school choice, which underlines those, and a system called virtual education, tell us a bit about how that affects the quality of education. These companies obviously are in it to make a buck. They're making profit here by getting into privatizing the education system. But what's the effect on the students?
So one of the terms that I came up with to talk about this moment, where we really do have an unprecedented move toward dismantling what we consider traditional public education, what that's being replaced by with high concentrations of poor people and high concentrations of people of color are charter schools, which are publicly financed but privately run. So they're not beholden to the same kinds of oversight and regulation as traditional public schools. But they depend on taxpayer dollars, or there's an offshoot of the homeschooling movement for virtual charter schools. These are schools where children as young as 5 years old can get the entirety of their education through computers. They're rarely having contact with other students, rarely having contact with teachers, and it costs school districts almost the same amount as a brick-and-mortar school. Or you'll have something like these alternatively certified teachers like Teach for America and other entities like that, which charge often struggling school districts between $2,000 to $5,000 per teacher that they supply as a kind of finder's fee. The thing about all of this is it's supposed to address the underachievement of children of color, low test scores, low graduation rates, the persistent problems that we see in certain kinds of communities. But the solutions that we've come up with are undoubtedly, like we're clear, making certain businesses very, very wealthy. Teach for America, which I mentioned, supplies teachers to these kinds of districts. The last I looked in 2016, it's been about a year, but they were worth almost $400 million. Wealthy children, upper middle class children, do not go to schools where their teachers are overwhelmingly trained with 5 weeks of training in the summer and put in classes, there'd be a complete uprising if you went into an upper middle class neighborhood or a wealthy neighborhood or a private school and touted the fact that the majority of our teachers have only had 5 weeks of training. So the question that I started to ask is, but why are the forms of education, the ways, the methods, the thinking about education so very different depending on the race and class of the children we're talking about educating? And there's something about that that started to feel fundamentally wrong to me.
That was Nolewe Rooks, Director of American Studies at Cornell University, and author of the new book titled Cutting School: Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. For more discussion of the issues raised in Rook's book, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, Free Radio in Santa Cruz, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Capital strikes back. For the last several years, I've mused about the rise of the very rich in politics. To be honest, they've always been in politics, but rarely as politicians. They saw as beneath them. The old robber barons used to walk into state legislatures, bags of money, and they literally bought the legislation they wanted. No more. Since the 90s, at least, we've seen super rich take local, state, and federal offices. I've often wondered why. In reading the latest book from the brilliant young scholar Kianga Mata Taylor, entitled From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, I found the answer. Professor Taylor cites the 1976 book, Ethics and Profits, The Crisis of Confidence in American Business, by Leonard Silk and David Vogel. The two men interviewed top business leaders who expressed contempt for Congress. One businessman said, "It is up to each of us, not some prostitute of a congressman pandering to get reelected, to decide what should be done." Get that? There it is.
by buying media, think tanks, and yes, Congress itself. They built the false logic of businessmen being better at politics than politicians. Thus, see the rise of that imperial idiot, Trump, creating chaos and disaster. Question answered from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Tax bill's passage, leaders of the Republicans did everything but to fall to their faces in supine servility to President Trump. They praised him with words of wonder, almost thanking him for the very air they breathed. For Americans, for men, for free people, the sight was as shocking as it was weird. Early Americans fought a bloody revolution to end the practice of free men bowing to kings. At the time, most of Europe believed that kings were ordained by God. A radical nation, the United States, threw that idea into the trash heap of history. Look today at these men who claim fealty, the so-called founding fathers. Fathers, maybe, but these are not their sons. They are Tories, servants of wealth, servants of capital, not fellow citizens. At the United Nations, the U.S. threatens the world to cut off foreign aid unless they bow to the empire. The world answered, 128 countries against, 9 in favor. The U.S. loses by a landslide. Politics of bullies reigns, both here and abroad. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. A favor. Either of you gals have my baby, don't worry, I'm willing to pay y'all. In an era in which sexual harassment, assault, and attacks on women seem commonplace, this case sounds like something out of a bad sci-fi movie. Is this real life? One wonders. It reminded me of the feminist futuristic classic The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, where men of money and means create a conservative theocracy where women of lower social standing are ordered and taught to serve the wealthy classes, even to the point of bearing them children whom they then have no claim whatsoever. That, in fact, was the true and hidden condition of America at its founding, when African women were raped at will only to give birth to children who could be sold for profit at whim. The politician who propositioned his staff members, Representative Trent Franks, Republican, 8th District, Arizona, was a prominent conservative known for family values. Well, this guy offered his staffers $5 million to sell their wombs. Some values, huh? Oh, he didn't want to use in vitro fertilization. He wanted to do it the old-fashioned way, you know, sex. Even though he's retired, doesn't it give you insight into how lawmakers think about regular people? I think so. The bodies of women are under capitalism's logic. Just another commodity, something to be bought and sold. That logic brought us the horrors and carnage of slavery, where black women were bred and sold like cattle. Over a century later, and the price has risen. Well, I guess that's progress, right? From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
What aspects of the 2016 U.S. presidential election have been under-investigated by mainstream press in 2017? Has the media downplayed the use of chemical weapons in America's prisons? Is indigenous use of the rights of nature being used successfully to prevent fracking and other destructive resource practices? Why would the economically robust Canadian province of Saskatchewan be witnessing declines in social indicators, and why hasn't mainstream media gotten to the bottom of it? What institutional factors contribute to the underreporting of relevant stories in Canada and beyond? As we begin a new year of broadcasts, the Global Research News Hour once again looks at the year past to examine some of the most important news stories that got little or no attention in the major media. We'll hear from Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored. We'll hear from John Chertow, Editor-in-Chief of Intercontinental Cry. And we'll hear from Patricia Elliott, Associate Professor with the University of Regina School of Journalism. On this week's program, 2017 Year in Review, the most censored international, Indigenous, and Canadian stories. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 5th, 2018. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Neither Channel 10 nor the White House gave away details of the plans and scenarios that the U.S. and Israel might pursue against Iran and Hezbollah. But it is obvious that one of these scenarios is to try to destabilize Iran from within by engineering disturbances or protests and activating a number of armed separatist groups. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, one of the Trump administration's closest Middle East allies, said as much openly in a TV interview some months ago. He warned his country was going to, quote, take the war inside Iran, unquote, as a preemptive measure, meaning before Iran tries to take the war into Saudi Arabia. It would not be surprising if the demonstrations held on Friday in several Iranian towns in protest at inflation were in some part a product of that strategy. That comes from the article, The U.S. and Israel's New Secret Anti-Iran Plans, by Abdel Bari Atwan, post-January 2nd, originally appearing at Rayal Yum. Lethally shooting around 20 Iranians through New Year's Day, including at least one policeman, suggests foreign interference. What's going on resembles March 2011 protests in Daraa, Syria. U.S.-supported armed protesters fired on police, instigating conflict. Security forces responded to violent armed insurgents, killing civilians and police attacking government offices. What began in Daraa spread elsewhere in Syria, things escalating into Obama's war, unresolved nearly 7 years later. That comes from the article, Foreign Intervention Behind Iran Protests, CIA Instigated Street Violence, by Stephen Lendman, posted January 2nd. While many of the demands are legitimate, all signs are pointing toward Western treachery in an attempt to break Iran in the final domino to fall in the Middle East before an even bigger confrontation is ignited. Destroying Iran would also destroy Hezbollah, weaken Syria and Russia, and threaten Israel. Whether or not it will succeed will depend on the level of subversion that has been possible by the United States intelligence apparatus since 2009 and the ability of Iran to squash the revolt. If anything can be learned from the 2009 revolution, Iran will move quickly and will smash the protests with an iron fist. However,
if the protests taking place in Iran today are indeed a color revolution, and if the West is committed, the path to Persia will likely see an escalation in activity, violence, and ultimately directly military confrontation by proxy and even by the U.S. military itself. That comes from the article, What is Happening in Iran? Is Another Color Revolution Underway? By Brandon Turbeville, posted December 31st, originally appearing at Activist Post. A senior U.S. official said that after 2 days of talks, the U.S. and Israel reached at a joint document which articulates full cooperation to deal with Iran's nuclear drive, its missile programs, and its other threatening activity in the region. The U.S. official said the document's goals was to translate President Trump's Iran speech to joint U.S.-Israeli strategic goals regarding Iran and to set up a joint work plan. At what the TV report described as a secret meeting at the White House, the U.S. and Israel specifically agreed to set up joint teams to handle various aspects of the Iranian threat. This includes a joint team, the report said, which will deal with Iranian activity in Syria and Tehran's support for the Hezbollah terror organization. This working group will also deal with drafting U.S.-Israeli policy regarding the day after in the Syrian civil war. That comes from the article, U.S. and Israel Sign Secret Plan to Take on Iran, Report, by Ali Najad, posted December 31st, originally appearing at The Iranian. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Here to guide us through some of the underemphasized and downright suppressed stories of 2017 is Andy Lee Roth. He is the associate director of Project Censored. Project Censored is the 41-year-old media research program based out of Sonoma State University in California, which now connects with hundreds of faculty and students at colleges across the U.S. and around the world. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm just fine, Michael. So good to be on the show with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So, most censored stories of 2016, 2017, are there any big themes in this year's release that maybe you'd like to, something that stands out?
Well, you know, I think one of the theme of our book this year is the idea of press freedoms in a so-called post-truth world. And so I think a lot of these stories this year focus in one way or another on this idea of are we all committed to the idea of an objective world with facts that are shared in common, and so that theme runs throughout the book and can certainly be found in a few of the top 25 stories, including one that just continues to stun me, a story that was originally broken by reporters at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London, where Crofton Black and Abigail Fielding Smith reported on how over at least a five-year period, the Pentagon paid a British PR firm, the British PR firm Bell Pottinger, more than $660 million to run a top-secret propaganda program in Iraq that involved the production, among other things, of fake al-Qaeda videos. Mm-hmm. So this story, just amazing, you know, over the past year when we've had pundits and politicians of all political stripes, as well as the establishment press crowing over fake news. The U.S. media completely ignored the story of how one of the most powerful U.S. government institutions, the Department of Defense, secretly used taxpayer money to create fake news of its own. So, you know, and the book is full of this year's top 25 list is full of, I think, equally stunning stories where you go, I can't believe that happened. And then on top of it, I can't believe that happened, and the corporate media, the so-called mainstream media, didn't deem it newsworthy.
Yeah, I think it's probably brought an extra currency to independent
programs like this one, and of course to your organization, that we really have to double up. I mean, the level of, well, deceit or omission of these important stories is so insidious.
Right. I mean, whether we have corporate news reporting on the statements of people like Kellyanne Conway, who in January of the year invoked alternative facts as the explanation for Sean Spicer's insistence that the Trump inauguration had the largest crowd ever, or just last month when Sarah Huckabee Sanders chastised the press. I think you're focusing on the wrong thing, she said, when they were asking about Trump retweeting these Islamophobic videos. And she said, whether it's a real video, the threat is real. So basically you had, Sarah Huckabee Sanders endorsing the idea of propaganda, the idea that fake information is okay as long as it pursues a real goal. So I think, yes, as much as ever, the importance of a truly free and robust independent press is just crucial as a counterbalance, as a bulwark against the kind of the notion of post-truth, alternative facts, fake news, and the like.
Now you just to drill down more, since Trump, for whatever reason, and the presidential election seems to be kind of a big, case study or whatever. You just mentioned that big data and dark money behind the 2016 election. That's your number five story. The mention of there is this the group the Cambridge Analytica, which is the affiliate of that larger British company, Strategic Communications Laboratories, and one of its the chief executive officer was quoted in the releases after Trump's victory as saying, quote, "We are thrilled that our revolutionary approach to data-driven communication has played such an integral part in President-elect Trump's extraordinary win," unquote. So that's interesting, and yet all we seem to hear about when it comes to fraud in the election is, oh, the Russians did it.
Right. And so, yes, it's super important to understand this broader picture, and that, as much as many of us here in the U.S. and around the world may be fixated on Donald Trump, again, the folks at Cambridge Analytica who use this data analytics company that uses micro-targeting as part of its election campaign consulting, what they said after the election is that, the candidate, referring to Trump, became the instrument for implementing a big data model. And this is big business. Cambridge Analytica earned an estimated $15 million overall during the 2016 campaign. And immediately after Trump's victory, the company's CEO was touring European conferences showcasing their success in the U.S. So they're literally capitalizing on that victory.
Maybe we could talk about a related story, and this has to do with the DNC, the Democratic National Convention, and the recognition of foul play in the choice of the Democratic candidate. This would be the number four story?
Number nine, on the DNC claiming the right to select the presidential candidate?
Number nine.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is another remarkable story that appeared, in a variety of places. Michael Fenato in The Observer, Ruby Kramer from BuzzFeed, Joshua Holland in The Nation reported on the results, basically, of there was a class action lawsuit filed in June of 2016 on behalf of the supporters of Bernie Sanders against the DNC and its former chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And the charges of the case were that the DNC had broke legally binding neutrality agreements in the primaries by basically positioning Hillary Clinton to be the nominee, to be the Democrats' nominee before a single primary vote was cast. And the news on this is not so much the lawsuit itself as what came out in the hearings for the lawsuit, where, among other things, the DNC attorney asserted that it would have been within the DNC's rights, and I'm going to quote here, to go into back rooms like they used to and smoke cigars and pick the candidate that way. The DNC attorney went on to say that's not the way it was done, but they could have, and that would have been their right. So what was at stake here was language from the DNC charter that requires the process to be impartial and even-handed. And what the DNC's attorneys in court were arguing was that a judge, the courts, could not determine what even-handed and impartial would count, what would amount to even-handed and impartial treatment in this case. Mm. So it's quite a remarkable story. And there's additional evidence from some of the other reporting that I just mentioned. Ruby Kramer in BuzzFeed was looking at the released DNC emails and showing that the DNC and Clinton's campaign had begun merging operations, consolidating research communications and media monitoring, not simply before Sanders had dropped out of the race, but even while he still remained a viable candidate much sooner, in other words, than had been previously reported or publicly disclosed.
Yes, a very, very suspicious omission. Maybe more cynical people might say mainstream media is kind of fronting for the higher-ups in the Democratic Party on that one. That's a scoop, or it should be.
Yeah, and I think, there's one more kind of footnote on this story that I think speaks to the idea of how politicized the news coverage is. First of all, there was not much news coverage of this particular angle, but then how politicized it is when there is. I mentioned the reporter Michael Senato, who reports for The Observer. Even his reporting, which consistently relied on official documents, including those leaked DNC emails and courtroom transcripts, as well as primary sources, when The Observer published his reports on this story, they were reported as opinion pieces rather than straight news reporting.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So they're fact-based, but they're not treated as news because they challenge some of the most cherished, notions of how the parties select their candidates in the primary stage of the election. So this is, again, I think this fits in this kind of theme of a sort of a post-truth world. We have news that isn't based on facts, but is treated as if it were. And then when we have fact-based reporting, like Sinato's reporting for The Observer, it's treated as opinion because it goes against the kind of dominant narrative.
Let's talk about a couple of the issues around the law enforcement and their kind of draconian measures that have been, because I think that's something that is also a common theme in a lot of censored your censored stories. So, like the number 22 story, militarization of law enforcement inside prisons. Number 19, use of chemical weapons inside of prisons, and number 11. The law enforcement surveillance of phone records in cooperation with AT&T collecting phone records. So, would you like to maybe address that chemical weapons one in particular really stands out. So,
yeah, this is again the power of independent reporting, the ability of reporters to connect the dots in ways that give us a deeper story. The key source on this, so this is from reports by Daniel Motar in The Nation and Sarah Lazare at Alternet. And they were reporting how chemical weapons, including several types of tear gas, are being used against prisoners in the United States, despite the fact that the International Chemical Weapons Convention of 1977 banned the use of these chemicals in warfare. But the background on this, the thing that makes Motar and Lazare's reporting possible is that since 2013, the War Resisters League has been documenting the use of tear gas in prisons. And so they've been getting letters from inmates describing the use of tear gas and pepper spray. But the other thing the War Resisters League has been doing is looking at who are the producers of the tear gases and pepper sprays that are used in these prison settings. And they document how companies, including Sabre, Combined Tactical Systems, Sage, Safariland, all sell tear gas to prisons in forms that are designed specifically for use in enclosed spaces. So on one hand, we have the idea that These chemical weapons are actually, their use violates international treaties about the uses of chemical weapons. And now, and on the other hand, we have companies, many of them U.S.-based, that are looking for new markets and finding that prisons and jails are ideal settings for their wares.
Yeah, this is another one I wanted to get through. Number 14, judges across U.S. using racially biased software to assess defendants' risk of committing future crimes. So that seems to be really moving into spooky territory.
Yeah, this is great reporting from a group of investigative reporters at ProPublica, Julia Ongwin, Jeff Larson, Surya Matu, and Lauren Kirshner. If we go back in time, in 2014, Eric Holder was then the U.S. Attorney General, and he publicly warned that the use of so-called risk assessments might be injecting bias into the nation's judicial system. Very little happened about that, but in May of 2016, ProPublica published the results of an extensive study they had done looking at data from Broward County in Florida, where they found risk scores, where they got access to risk scores of more than 7,000 people who had been arrested in that county. And the risk scores in Broward County are used to determine which defendants are sufficiently low risk to be released on bail pending their trials. But in many other places across the U.S., these risk scores are used by judges also to determine the length of sentences. So anyway, the risk score is a significant thing. Here's what the ProPublica reporters found. They found that the risk scores produced by this algorithm proved to be, quote, remarkably unreliable in forecasting violent crime. Only 20% of the people predicted to commit violent crimes went on to do so. In fact, the algorithm was only somewhat more accurate than a random coin toss. And the formula was particularly likely to falsely flag black defendants as future criminals, wrongly labeling them this way almost twice as often as white and their white counterparts. The company that produces the software that is used in Broward County, the algorithm that the Broward County judges use, and it's widely used across the country, is a company called North Point, and the software is called COMPAS, which is an acronym, COMPAS. When ProPublica and others have attempted to get the kind of what are the criteria the algorithm used, North Point has argued that algorithm is a proprietary matter, and they will not publicly disclose the calculations that COMPAS uses to determine defendants' risk scores. So the ProPublica report can show massive disparities, but it's in effect a black box as to what about the algorithm is generating those disparities. Mm. And that raises serious questions about whether defendants can really have a fair chance to challenge the ways that those the use of those algorithms impact them.
We're running a little low on time. I want you to maybe bring up one or two good news stories, because I find that you usually do have something that's good. I think there's one on an Indian resilience against in coping with climate change, and there's another one on a constitutional challenge for again on the around mitigating climate change.
Yes, I want to add one more to that mix. So I'll speak just quickly on the young plaintiffs invoking constitutional grounds for climate protection. This is the case Juliana versus the United States that will come to trial early in the next year, February 5th, 2018. And in this trial, which is being brought by, it was originally brought by plaintiffs ages 8 to 19, arguing that the federal government and the fossil fuel industry have knowingly endangered the plaintiffs by promoting the burning of fossil fuels, and that constitutes violations of their constitutional and public trust rights. And although this has been challenged several times, judges have consistently upheld the case, and it will go to court. And I think we should all keep February 5th on our calendars, because there are going to be amazing protests at courts all across the country on behalf of these plaintiffs who are saying that the defendant, that whether or not, what I'm trying to say here is that the defendants have so profoundly damaged the home planet that the plaintiff's fundamental constitutional rights to life and liberty are being threatened. And so this is an important case in terms of one of the first times that climate protection has been argued for on constitutional grounds. But the other story, if we have a little more time, the other story I would love to point people to is a good news story involving policing. It's our number 24 story on eight use of force policies that would prevent killings by the police.
Yes.
This story is the result of a study done last year by Campaign Zero, a police reform group that formed in the aftermath of the Ferguson protests. And as Jamila King reported in Mike, the study was the first wide-scale analysis to demonstrate the connection between differing use of force policies and the rate of police killings. So the Campaign Zero report identifies eight guidelines, things like requiring officers to de-escalate situations before resorting to force, restricting their use of chokeholds, prohibiting officers from shooting at moving vehicles, and requiring comprehensive reporting by officers when there are incidents involving police use of force. And what Campaign Zero found was that on average, looking at police departments across the country, and I believe it's the 91 largest police departments in the country, they found that on average, each additional use of force policy that was implemented is associated with a 15% reduction in killings. So these use of force policies are excellent in terms of protecting civilians. But the part that really interests me about this story is that they also found that, you know, that despite resistance from police unions who claim that more restrictive use of force policies actually endanger officers, on the contrary, what Campaign Zero found, what their study shows, is that the numbers of officers assaulted or killed in the line of duty decreases in proportion with the number of regulations adopted by those departments. So these policies, this is why I think of this as a good news story, enhanced use of force policies protect not only civilians but also police officers in the line of duty.
I think we got maybe a little under a minute left to go, but I wanted to give you a chance to maybe highlight some of the features in Censored 2018, besides the top 25 most censored stories.
Thanks, Michael. Of course. Yes. Well, we have our usual chapter on junk food news and news abuse, which are focused especially on election issues this year. The Media Democracy in Action chapter, we have great contributions by Rachel Jolly from the Index on Censorship, the new good folks at Tribeworthy, Kevin Gastola and Rania Kalik, Unauthorized Disclosure, their new podcast, and Ginny Gebhardt at Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've got a graphic chapter by Adam Bessie and Peter Glanting called Trump Universe that is really cool. Nikki and I have been working on that, getting a graphic chapter in the book for several years. And then we're super proud. The book closes out with chapters by Ralph Nader on breaking through power. And I believe we had this book has what I believe is the last published piece by Edward S. Herman, who gave us a 30 years review of the Herman and Chomsky propaganda model. And we're so, we miss Ed Herman so much, but we're very pleased that we've got this piece that he wrote for us this past summer. So Andy, we think it's a pretty great book, and we hope people will have a look at it.
Andy Lee Scott, it's been a pleasure speaking to you again. Look forward to talking to you again in 2018.
Sounds great, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you. So we've been speaking with Andy Lee Roth. He is the Associate Director of Project Censored and is speaking to us from California.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
The online media platform Intercontinental Cry is a nonprofit newsroom producing public interest journalism centered on indigenous peoples, climate change, and international human rights. Joining us once again to discuss some of the most underreported stories of indigenous peoples and indigenous struggle over the past year is John Shurto. A member of the Mohawk Nation, John Shurto is editor-in-chief of Intercontinental Cry and founder of IC Magazine. He joined us from Winnipeg. John, let's get right into it. You brought to our attention a story about the Ponca Nation in Oklahoma and its efforts to combat fracking, which is causing earthquakes and poisoning the water that they depend upon for drinking and for their livestock. The story involves the invocation of something called the Rights of Nature as a legal device to prevent further destructive industrial activities. Can you give us some more details?
As many of our listeners already know, dozens of communities in the United States, as well as several countries, including New Zealand, India, Ecuador, Nepal, and Bolivia, have now passed laws that recognize the rights of nature. Surprisingly, however, we haven't seen any indigenous nations adopt these important measures that offer us all additional means to legally protect the natural world. Well, on October 20th of 2017, the Ponca tribe of Oklahoma took the historic step of agreeing to add a statute to their constitution enacting the rights of nature. The decision to recognize the rights of nature came in response to the severe environmental harms that the Ponca have witnessed ever since the fracking industry began operating on their land. In 2017, there were at least 440 reported earthquakes in and around the Ponca Reservation, in a state that was essentially earthquake-free before the fracking industry moved into the area. What's more, as you pointed out, the water throughout the reserve has become too toxic to drink, bathe in, or even allow livestock to drink. Well, there's no telling how effective the rights of nature will be in resolving this, you know, ongoing severe environmental crisis. But with the incredible amount of momentum that the rights of nature gained in 2017, it will, in the very least, provide the Ponca with a new legal front and the international community to rally around.
Yes, that's the whole issue of the rights of nature. It seems like it's like a new legal mechanism, and it's interesting to see it being put into play and curious to reflect on why these sorts of stories aren't getting more exposure. Speaking of the rights of nature, I wanted to maybe give you a chance to briefly remark about the a story about communities in the northwest region of Ecuador that invoked those rights for the first time since they were enshrined in the country's constitution. I mean, maybe a little bit of background on that battle and its significance.
Sure. Well, it was a very significant win, I think, even though the ruling that ultimately came down from the Ecuadorian court wasn't ideal. It was still an important win, ultimately, not only for the Afro-descendant community of Lachaquita and the Awa community of Guadalito, but also for the overarching worldwide rights of nature movement. Well, the two communities approached the court just 2 years after Ecuador finally recognized the rights of nature in their own constitution, and they took two oil palm companies to court over the environmental harms that they have caused on their ancestral lands. And Judge Juan Francisco Gabriel Morales Suarez only partially accepted the community's claims, and ultimately he evaded a determination that the oil palm companies were guilty of causing any damage. But he nevertheless acknowledged that the two communities had rights, that they were, in effect, the guardians of the rights of nature within their lands. And, you know, he then shuffled around the responsibility to like a dozen or two different government departments, rather than pinpointing it and forcing the two palm oil companies into bankruptcy, basically to take responsibility for the damage that has been caused.
So essentially, it's a slap in the wrist.
Yeah, but it's still a good one, I guess. You know, because at least there was a slap. You know, and the two communities in partnership with Various other organizations are still working to overturn the judgment and get a stronger ruling that is more indicative of the spirit and intent of the rights of nature.
Hmm. Your next story comes out of the Sierra Madre in Mexico. It was a land reclamation case stemming from a century-long conflict between the Huichol peoples and the Mestizo ranchers. Could you give us some more of the lowdown on that struggle and where it's headed?
Well, it's been going on, the struggle, since the early 1900s, when the Mexican state seized 10,500 hectares of the Huichol's ancestral land. Now, in September 2016, the Huichol finally headed down to this ancestral land in a process of reclamation. The Mexican court had ruled that the Huicholes could reclaim a 140-acre plot of farmland, which had since been occupied by Mestizo ranchers. Now, the ranchers themselves, claimed rights to the area based on decades of possession, as well as the existence of deeds and decrees issued by various governments, as well as their capacity to work the land. The Huicholes, despite that, still wanted to, reclaim this land that was wrongfully taken from them. So they physically did so with the backing of the court, but not exactly with the backing of the government or with police forces. And that is a significant point to make. Now, this whole situation is a powder keg. And I'm continually amazed that, we haven't seen any severe violence come out of this ongoing land reclamation. Because many of the ranchers in the area are openly racist towards the Huichol, and many of them have on several occasions tried to incite violence and pressure the government to send in the troops. In one case, the one landowner claimed to have proof that the Huichol were armed, even though they were not. Now, if Mexico had been operating under Chile's anti-terrorism law, for example, there would have been, severe violence. In another instance, a group of landowners took a group of Huicholes captive after they went to the local town to buy some food. And then, of course, there was the tragic assassination of Miguel Vasquez Torres, who was at the forefront of the legal fight to recover these 10,500 acres. Miguel, who served as a guide to a team of IC reporters that were on site in 2016, was gunned down this past May alongside his brother, who was also actively involved in the restitution project. Now, the assassinations was a tremendous blow to the Huichol, but even so, it has to be said that calm and reason has largely prevailed. And that's likely why we've seen so little coverage of this struggle. The majority of the ranchers and the Huichol have been routinely urging the government to intervene. The government finally decided to do so in September of last year, after a group of ranchers set up a roadblock preventing the Huichol from reclaiming another small portion of land, again under court order. After that happened, the federal government agreed to set up a working group, one of the main objectives of which is to generate funding for the ranchers to, lower the risk of violence.
Wow, so that's something that could really start to erupt further in 2018, sounds like.
At any moment.
Uh-huh.
Literally. We will be watching the situation closely. We have reporters going down there regularly to keep us updated.
Perfect. This next story might be a little upsetting for those in left solidarity circles. You report on violence in the wake of the recent Nicaraguan municipal elections, which has the Sandinista government targeting Yatama, an indigenous-led political party. Four were left dead, dozens injured, and 50 being taken allegedly as political prisoners. What are the issues animating that dispute?
Well, that is a very complex question, one that goes back to the 60s and back to when U.S. was at war with
the Contra War.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, we can't really get into all the issues here, but essentially, for the past 30 years, the Indigenous Yatama Party has been slowly gaining political strength within the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua. And so during this recent municipal elections on November 5th, Yatama lost control of four municipalities. Now Yatama, as well as many as well as other opposition parties to the FSLN, protested what they denounced as yet another fraudulent election. According to the reports that we received, the Yatama alleged that more than 180 election anomalies. In one case, Yatama supporters were being flat-out turned away from polling stations. So the riot police and the military were flown in to crush the protests, and crush it they did. To correct an earlier point you made, at least seven people were killed.
Okay.
The initial reports were that four people were killed, and later reports it was seven. And then we had the dozens and dozens were injured, and others were arrested and jailed. And as if that wasn't bad enough, groups of FSLN supporters decided to go on a rampage, likely in response to the to Yatama's claims. They burned down the Yatama's Miskito language radio station, as well as their headquarters. The famous warrior Indian statue was destroyed, and Yatama's own flag was replaced by the flag of the Sandinista state. Now, when the dust began to settle, just a couple of days later, word came down that the Sandinista had ordered the capture or execution of Brooklyn Rivera, who was the political and spiritual leader of Yatama. We spoke to Rivera on November 10th, one day before he was scheduled to make a public appearance to celebrate Yatama's 30th anniversary. We had pointed out that he may be arrested, but he replied quickly that he simply has to celebrate with his people, regardless of the risk to his life. Unfortunately, that celebration, you know, took place without incident. Over 1,000 people attended the gathering. But the big question now for Yatama and the Miskito is, where do they go from here? Given the long and bitter history between Yatama and really all the Miskito people and the Nicaragua government, it's not clear where Yatama, which is a formidable political force, has to go, given that they have now lost basically all their political power. There's also the question of the colonos from other parts of Nicaragua who continue to stream into Miskito territory, claiming their land, and shooting up Miskito communities and houses. There's houses there that are just filled with bullets. Elders, children have been shot and killed, and the government has refused to intervene. How to resolve that situation as well? Without any political power there.
Yeah.
So it's a complex situation.
Yes, but certainly it's like the other ones you mentioned, very important and quite fascinating, and I think emblematic of the kind of journalism that Intercontinental Cry has been putting out for the last dozen years. Is there anything you could say in closing about how Intercontinental Cry itself has advanced over the past year? Are there any challenges or changes that maybe you'd like to mention?
Well, the challenges are the same as always. You know, we continue to struggle to find allies who can work with us in editing and writing and help us report on the frontline struggles that other newsrooms aren't covering. As well as finding allies in an organizational sense to help us build capacity and find ways to make IC financially sustainable, because there is really no funding available for Indigenous media in Canada or the United States. We have to rely on funding from individuals, and it's very hard to run a successful fully staffed newsroom from $5 donations. We still get by, but IC is staffed essentially by one single person. And it's not enough given the sheer amount of ground that we have to cover because we are a global news group. But we are continuing to, you know, find our way and find means to, you know, stay afloat without compromising our vision or undermining the integrity of our work or undermining the nations that we represent and the struggles that they are putting their lives on the line for.
Well, John, we really appreciate the work that you and your crew of warriors are putting together on a regular basis, and it's certainly been a pleasure having you on the show and on our station just to keep us up to date on these very important movements and struggles worldwide. All the best to you and to IC.
No, go well. Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with John Chertow. He is editor-in-chief of Intercontinental Cry. If you wish to support his work, please visit the site intercontinentalcry.org and click support on the menu bar.
Patricia Elliott is associate professor with the University of Regina's School of Journalism. She's also one of the faculty evaluators with Project Censored. She joins us again to talk about some of the underreported stories out of Canada. Professor Elliott, welcome.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
So I thought we should lead our conversation with the story of Indigenous people invoke treaty rights over hydropower license.
Right.
That's in your home province of Saskatchewan. Could you provide some more details about that?
This is a story that student Caitlin Taylor was looking into. Basically, we had a hydro station here. The license came up for renewal after 50 years. It was time to renew again. There had been a lot of downstream issues for northern Indigenous communities, particularly around the Saskatchewan River Delta, related in part to the hydro station. But when Caitlin looked for news articles about this license coming up for renewal, she couldn't find anything. She only knew about it through conversations with people from up north. And so this is why she kind of keyed in on that as an underreported story.
Interesting. And is this the kind of story that, like, whenever there's issues around hydro, they might bring up other elements, but they tend to miss the Indigenous angle?
That's partly it, but in this case, they didn't even really bring up the story itself. A concern for Indigenous people in the area because they were finding that it was affecting lake levels and potentially affecting the delta as well. So there's a lot of trapping and fishing that were being impacted by the dams on the Saskatchewan River. I guess that message just wasn't getting out to the wider Saskatchewan community. It's also physically isolated from where the major news outlets are, so that could be part of it. And basically, newsrooms just don't have the people on the ground. They don't have the reporters able to travel. So that was a story that really went under the radar that probably shouldn't have.
There's another Saskatchewan-centric story that your students brought forward. It delves into depressed social indicators in yes. Saskatchewan that are easily available through Statistics Canada, but no major news networks seem to have connected the dots and explored what's at the root of those indicators. So what has independent media reporting revealed about that situation?
Well, in this case, we often hear, like in the mainstream media, if a study comes out or a report from StatsCan, we'll hear, you know, very sporadically about, you know, a crime rate or maybe something to do with HIV. But what Brenna Engel found was that no one was really connecting the dots. And in fact, you know, there were a few alternative media reports that did so, but mainly she was just looking at the Statistics Canada reports that they issued. So Saskatchewan has had this history of the past decade of really being promoted as the place to be, where there's a lot of economic development, things have been going great. I know that story is changing this year, but we've been fed this story that there's a tremendous amount of wealth and prosperity in the province. Yet at the same time, the social indicators are really depressed compared to other parts of Canada in terms of things like everything from drunk driving to domestic abuse. University tuition fees are the highest here. You know, we've got the lowest number of bilingual speakers, highest level of HIV. So what Brenna wondered was, why isn't this a story? Not just a story about, for example, drug use, but a story about all of these things together. Why is Saskatchewan seeming to lag in these areas?
Interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have a sort of a general take on the kinds of stories in Canada that are getting routinely underreported or outright distorted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, obviously, Indigenous stories are not covered as well as they should be. There have been improvements, but if you go to, if you live in a small town, your small town paper may not be covering what's the news from the First Nation that's right next door to this small town, for example. So there's a lot of continuing blind spots out there. The unfounded story from the Globe and Mail was a great example of a thing that everybody knew about. I mean, if you're female in Canada, you know that reports of sexual assault get dismissed. I mean, you just know that from experience and from your friends' experiences. That is something that the Globe and Mail went after in a very systematic way and did a great job. But we would have seen that in alternative media long before the Globe and Mail got a hold of it. We've heard, you know, people speaking on it in forums like community radio, the alternative press, but it's taken a little longer. The value of mainstream media coming on board is, in that case, they were able to throw a whole lot of resources at that story.
Interesting. Yeah. Are we seeing any kind of a trend of, you know, maybe community radio giving, you know, kind of, I don't know, tipping off mainstream media, or are they kind of like two solitudes?
In some ways, they're two solitudes to a point, and eventually that sort of hidden transcript coming out of community media makes its way into mainstream consciousness, but a lot of key issues will show up first on community radio. They will show up first in alternative newspapers or in community access television even. And that's the great thing about alternative media. The whole point of the Project Censored exercise for my students is to get them looking at those sources, because that's where you see it first. I mean, even something like recycling was considered a radical concept even 20 years ago, and would only be appearing in, you know, real serious discussion on it in environmental magazines, sort of alternative green magazines. Now that's considered a mainstream topic, right? I know from my own experience working with a women's magazine back in the 80s, the story of missing and murdered Indigenous women was well known in women's communities. It was well known in the alternative press, and was being covered to the extent that people could do so. It took a couple of decades for it to break through.
And
it's really important to pay attention to alt media.
Yeah, I think that does speak to the issue of power dynamics, mm-hmm. and like who has power and then who's in a position to say, oh, that doesn't really matter, or whatever. So I'm wondering then if you could describe the current media landscape in Canada and developments, say, in the last couple of years that might be contributing to this suppression or neglect of certain sorts of stories.
Well, probably one of the biggest developments is under the Harper government, support for media development in Canada completely had the pin pulled out, and the Trudeau government has not replaced that pin. So even, like, for example, the magazine landscape is really populated by nonprofit magazines are like probably one of the biggest contributors to magazine journalism in Canada. They lost a lot of their government support. So nonprofit media has been really, really struggling. And that's at a loss to our media landscape. People tend to focus on, the mainstream market-based for-profit businesses. But we've got in Canada a huge and very important sector of nonprofit and co-op media that most people don't realize the level of the cuts that were leveled against that sector. We're aware of the cuts to CBC during that period because CBC is like one thing and it's very present and there's Friends of Canadian Broadcasting to sound the alarm. But when it comes to nonprofit media, it's like a lot of little cuts to little media outlets. That's a problem because as we're just talking about, it's these smaller, more community-connected outlets that are really the leading edge of stories that matter to Canadians.
Yeah. You were talking earlier about the lack of proximity of newsrooms to the stories, especially those affecting rural peoples, people in indigenous communities. Are we seeing trends in terms of that evaporation of some of these local newsrooms and the impacts they're having?
Yeah, there has been a big decline over the last decade in local newspapers and local independent television stations in Canada. The Canadian government, even now, is just sitting back and watching that whole local news landscape implode and doing nothing. Quebec has moved in with some funding assistance to shore up some of its local news outlets. Elsewhere in Canada, there hasn't been any response from Ottawa, and that's hugely irresponsible because media development is important in Canada. Media, and especially local news, is part of the infrastructure of democracy. It's infrastructure like roads and rail lines. We need local news. We need journalists, and Canada used to provide, a pretty healthy level of media development assistance, as other countries do around the world. But those programs, as I mentioned, were mostly canceled. So we've seen, I know in Manitoba, there have been newspaper closures there. I think this year, Grandview lost at the Exponent, which is a 117-year-old paper. In Saskatchewan, we lost the Moose Jaw Times Herald, which was, again, more than 100 years old, had served the Moose Jaw community as a daily paper. Now gone with no replacement, and that's a big problem facing Canadians.
We've been speaking with Patricia Elliott, associate professor with the University of Regina's School of Journalism and one of the faculty evaluators with Project Censored. She joined us from the University of Regina. Before we go, we'd like to remind listeners that Global Research founder and editor, Professor Michel Chosadovsky, will be visiting two Canadian cities this month to speak to public audiences about the Korean crisis and the threat of a nuclear war emerging out of it. He speaks in Winnipeg January 15th from 2:30 to 4 at the University of Manitoba's University College in room 244, before speaking that same evening at 7 p.m. at the University of Winnipeg's Eckhart Gramatay Hall. On Tuesday, January 16th, the same day U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson meets in Vancouver with Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland to discuss the Korean crisis, Professor Chosadovsky will speak in the city at the Vancouver Public Library at 350 West Georgia Street at 7 p.m. Please check the website globalresearch.ca for complete details. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs weekly on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email us at globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.